now call the Chief Minister to exercise his right to decline from the second reading of the appropriation.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, we started on Tuesday to debate this bill, and it's already Friday. A dozen times fly when we're enjoying ourselves. Mr. Speaker, the appropriation bill this year has been held in the context of the results of the referendum now exactly 2 weeks ago since we held the referendum. The context of 14 difficult days for Europe, 14 difficult days for the United Kingdom, and of course 14 concerning days for Gibraltar. And I think that has had the effect of tempering the way that perhaps appropriation debate has gone. And I want to thank honourable members for that, although I have detected some elements of the partisan in some of the things that were said in the context of the debate, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to respond to those aspects of what was said, and ensure that the record is not in any way tarnished by some of the incorrect and frankly misleading statements that we have heard in the context of the debate in this House. Mr. Speaker, despite the moment in which we live, it is important that hands does not rest with those incorrect references in it. Mr. Speaker, for most of the members on the other side, I think this was their first budget debate, and I want to congratulate them all, without exception, for their maiden speeches. In 2003, all of us who were near on the other side were congratulated Bar 1. That one now replies for the government. And they wasn't congratulated, obviously, because of the greatest civil gain of all time, as one of the women of the victim men referred to him. Didn't like to single me out for praise on any occasion. Well, Mr. Speaker, I thank him for the work that made me strong enough to be able to usurp him from his position 5 years ago. Mr. Speaker, they made maiden speeches which contained many, many rookie errors, and I will have no regard but to deal with those to correct the record. Mr. Speaker, in 2003, the year that I made my maiden address from those benches, I reminded the House that Gladstone had observed in Westminster that silence was, as it were, of the stomach of the country, from which all other organs take their turn. Well, Mr. Speaker, this is a very, very healthy country indeed, because the finances of this nation are now stronger than ever, and anybody who cares to look at the state of our finances and analyze them with a critical eye but without a view of simply denigrating for the sake of it would take exactly that view. And in these difficult challenging times, it is absolutely right that it should be that way, and the management and stewardship of the economy for the past 5 years, and of the public finances in particular, is what brings us to that moment. So, Mr. Speaker, the debate about public finances that honourable members have engaged in, and the way that they've addressed issues in the past few days, has been a little different to the attitude that they've put through the general election. And when I say to the honourable members and I say members of it, I don't mean to include the honourable independent member whose contribution I will address on its own at the end because he shadows all of our portfolios. I'm referring to the official, the current official party of opposition, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, that debate that we had, not since last season, and in fact, Mr. Speaker, not since last November, we've had that debate, Mr. Speaker, since the honourable leader of the opposition took the leadership of the opposition 3 years ago, is one which is really based on attempting to present an excessively negative view of everything that relates to the public finances and the world, simply for the purposes of trying to create a fear in people that the government is somehow not managing finances properly. And I say, Mr. Speaker, in the 3 years we serve all the leaders of the in the leadership of the GOP, because of course it couldn't have been thus under the former leader of the opposition, the Honourable, the backbenchers, we used to know him in the days before he left, but the former Chief Minister, who often tried to say that he was going to resign, Mr. Speaker, because you see, the first meeting that we had in this house in 2011, when we came here as, you know, first-face ministers, a lot of us except for the veteran, over time, Mr. Speaker, to take over a government, we heard, and it's important that members of the opposite understand this, because this is the political moment with the inheritance which they still live, we heard the Honourable Sir Peter Kahana tell us that under the GOP administration which had ended days before, they were burning so much cash on projects that they were about to hit the ceiling of debt, and that he would therefore support a GSLP Liberal government bringing a motion to the House to exceed the ceiling of debt. They're proven that they have pretended to make their own. So the Honourable Mr. Peterson became the leader of the opposition. It won, which showed the system. Because the inheritance, what the Honourable, the former deputy leader of the opposition, used to say with his usual smirk, was the golden legacy of the GSP, which Mr. Yama has now taken to refer to. The golden legacy of the GSP was an abject surrender, Mr. Speaker, on the day of the ceremonial opening, not on the first day for questions, not on the first day for debates, not at the first appropriation debate, on the ceremonial opening. Well, we were just, you know, giddy with having been in the government and still trying to work out the Monday. So, Chief Minister, I was the one who had to stand up and not him. He was saying to us, I recognize that the cash burn rate is so high that you're going to exceed the ceiling of debt, and so if you bring a resolution, I will support it. Now, the Kaiser would be happy to know, Mr. Speaker, that in fact what we did would not accept the invitation to greet Gibraltar's ceiling of debt because of the open spending. We stopped it. We stopped every single GSP project until we were able to analyze it, until we were able to make it more affordable, until we were able to ensure that Gibraltar did not, because of the GSP's administration of our public finances, because of the GSP's administration of our public finances, we did not have to breach the ceiling of debt by resolution of this House, as the former Chief Minister had invited us to do. So, Mr. Speaker, with that context, let alone with the doomsday memo from David Galliam, the own financial secretary, telling us that we were running out of money if we didn't bring the motion. With that context, Mr. Speaker, the things that they have said today, and again, I'm talking to the official, the current official party of opposition, not to the other lady, the things that they have said today ring hollower than the inside of a drum, Mr. Speaker. Because you see, Mr. Speaker, there was talk of there being an elephant in this room. And I want to say people with that, Mr. Speaker, only in one particular respect. There isn't an elephant in the room, Mr. Speaker. There isn't an elephant in the room. Some sensible, honourable members have referred to an elephant in the room. There are 10 elephants in this room. 10 elephants that have a memory that will not allow members opposite to forget what happened when they were in charge of the administration of Gibraltar's affairs. 10 long memories that will not allow them to get away with pretending to be prudent when in fact they are censoring, Mr. Speaker. Absolute censoring. And I'm going to deal with those issues, Mr. Speaker, in detail as I go through their contribution. In particular, I'm going to deal with the issue of Mr. Clinton saying, oh, that the interest rates are lower now than they were before. Well, Mr. Speaker, look at that. Interest rates may be lower now. And I do the analysis that he doesn't need me to do about LIBOR and the Bank of England rates. He probably understands that which this was not convenient to deal with the reality of in the context of the speech that he wanted to make. But it is true, Mr. Speaker, that today, as 6 months ago, and it's probably in 6 months from now, if the Honourable Member went to BFS to buy a sofa, you'll see from the advertisement in the Sky News channel that you can probably get one with 0% interest if you finance it over some money. But that's not what a nation financing over 30 years through its company structure is going to pay, as you well understand, and I will deal with that. And that's why 3.85% is set for next year in deal, but I will deal with that in detail as well. Because, I mean, I prefer, Mr. Speaker, like the CIA, elephant, like the CIA, we don't forget, Mr. Speaker. Either the things that they said now, or the things that they used to say under the banner of GOP in the past 16 years. I want to start, Mr. Speaker, with an excellent contribution in one of our daily newspapers by a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Jeffries. I don't know what Honourable Members read this contribution, but it deals with all of the issues that we have been dealing with in this house since the Honourable Leader of the Opposition took over the current official opposition party, the GOP, and his attempt to center or trick us into the road of austerity, that is the road that we have pursued, which is of investment in Gibraltar, investment in public services, and ensuring that our community prospers as it can. And it starts like this, Mr. Speaker, from yesterday. I'm sure Honourable Members might have read the first few sentences and decided it wasn't worth going on. But I think it's worth them hearing it from me, because it's important that this letter be on hand, Mr. Speaker. Spending taxpayers' money is the heading of the letter. Jennifer, I wish to congratulate the government of Gibraltar on their budget for Brexit. I guess they stopped to be fair, Mr. Speaker, but it gets very big. The government of Gibraltar has made a sound judgment in not following the United Kingdom in its austerity plan. I do have concerns about the economic judgments made by the opposition in particular in relation to the government of the government of Gibraltar there. I wanted to point out, by way of this letter to Gibraltarian voters, how important it is that the government spends money. In the context of Gibraltar, the government pays for many things, like Mount Avernia, the health service, the tourist stadium, the buses, schools, housing estate, and now in the summer, the building pavilion. All these things are important to have. If the focus is to pay the debt, then there would have to be spending that. To the ordinary worker or pensioner, spending cuts would be like living in America, where you have to pay for everything after paying tax, rather than the tax to be used by governments to pay for things people need to have for saving lives. Even where the government's debt exists, governments borrow, they borrow that money at a cheaper interest rate than any citizen going to their local bank and asking for a loan or having to use a credit card. So only 6 states or towns that the debt would have to be paid. But the government can have the ability to increase taxes, let's say on businesses or tourists, to keep finances stable. But if you do it really well, like we are, then you can actually bring taxes and costs down. If you look at the UK, the experiment of austerity has been sold to the working class as the need to cut government debt in a hurry or else you mortgage the country's future. So, for the last 6 years, the government has been cutting its spending and therefore increasing the university tuition fees that now students have to pay to the tune of £9,000 per year of study. You now have to pay for your own social care or sell your house to pay for it. Children's centres providing specialised childcare have to pay. Libraries and swimming pools have also been closed. Or in the case of my college, making half of the teaching staff redundant, closing down courses and not having had a pay rise for 6 years. Contrast that to the position in Gibraltar, where we've just spoken about university. Your taxpayers are paying more tax than ever, and there has been no cut to the UK government debt. In fact, it has increased. As spending cuts have led to job cuts in the public sector and less investment in the private, so less taxes paid. no wonder the cuts in government spending have been linked to a rise in mental health problems as people feel they have to pay more for things and less money. So I would argue to voters and developers to be cautious about el cuento of the government debt. Those that argue about the debt, to my mind, only want to cut services to allow business to pay even less tax. Good government means investment and spending in areas where the people and the economy need it the most. That is why workers pay taxes, because it makes common sense and you get something back to it. So enjoy your publicly taxpayer funded amounts in the knowledge you do get something back. Mr. Speaker, I'm tempted to sit down and commend the bill to the House. And in addition, in Gibraltar, the cost of business costs going down as well. Now, I know they would wish me to do that, Mr. Speaker. But then, I would not spend the time I am required to spend correcting everything they said, which just has absolutely no basis in fact. They should be so lucky, Mr. Speaker. For example, I'm not surprised that Danny and the Westman don't want to come to the music festival this year. They're not an act that we were thinking of signing anyway, and that they don't want to hear what I have to say, but anyway. And for them, seeing the new configuration, I'm almost reminded of that great old poem, the charge of the likelihood. Yes, man to right of him, what yes, man to left of him, volleyed unfunded, and he's about to be. Anyway. Oh, I must just pause to give an element of advice to honourable members of it, because having sat in this place since 2003, by no measure the longest sitting member of this House, because I am, of course, of the age that is the president of Joe Bogana, and he's been here for 34 years, I've been alive for 34 years, so I'm very far from being able to claim to be the longest sitting person here. I have been here for all the time that the Honourable Leader of the Opposition has been here. Because he arrived in 2007 and I arrived in 2006. And I have to tell you that, in fact, I can tell you from hand into the street, that if they go back and look at the photographs, the people who have sat next to Mr. Peter since he arrived here in 2007 have not come back after the following election. Because they've either been left out by the voter on both sides. So they've either been left out by the voter or they've been left out by the executive committee that might have selected them. So the speaking arrangements are a matter entirely for them. But I think this is more than a coincidence, Mr. Speaker. But anyway, maybe Mr. Phillips would have stayed in the rocket chair at the end of the road. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to go through the analysis, whether Dan and the Yesman want me to or not. And I'm going to ensure that I deal with the issues of government rent, especially the state way as well, because they seem to want us to increase rent further, and we've been very careful with how we increase rent, because we don't want to increase rent in a way that is punitive, for the reason that Mr. Phillips suggested that it should be punitive. I detected in him a desire to people pay more. And we figure that's good enough, that will never be the opposite of people in administration. In my initial address on the appropriation, though I said that in the world of history, we are now in a time for extraordinary people to do extraordinary things. Speaker, I heard very little from the official opposition that suggested that they were ready to be our partners in doing so, but they did say some extraordinarily contradictory things in the context of the six speeches that they delivered. And they demonstrated, Mr. Speaker, that there was very little vision in their approach, there was very little positive critique, there was much more criticism. And Mr. Speaker, at a time when we do need substantive understanding of what is going on, substantive contribution from different sides of the house, this is a time, Mr. Speaker, of great clarity. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, there is a fantastic quote from Lenin, who is not somebody who wanted to often quote, Mr. Speaker, although the honourable Mr. Bogana might take issue with that, but Lenin is reputed, and he has said, no doubt in his mother tongue, that there are decades where nothing happens, and then there are weeks when decades happen, Mr. Speaker. And I would say that in the past 2 weeks, decades have happened. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable the Leader of the Opposition started his contribution in effect trying to say that that whatever we might have done in the budget, because I think he'd written the contribution before he knew that I was going to say so, so he tried to do it in a way that, that might have gone in either direction. In effect, Mr. Speaker, he was laying for us a Gordian knot. Whether I raised costs or whether I lowered costs in Gibraltar of doing business or taxation, I would be doing the bad thing. Of course, if I raised costs, then his attack would be because the cost of business was going up, or because the taxation was going up, etc. If I lowered costs, then I was being part of Christmas and I wasn't responsible, and you know, because it would have been a bit toxic if it wasn't so transparent. But it's not a question when you're dealing with a sophisticated community like the one that we're dealing with, of being either part of Christmas or food. It's not that easy, Mr. Speaker. It's about careful calibration. But he never gives us the advantage of saying that he's got it right. Although I did hear him, through gritted teeth, congratulate us for this year's economic performance. So, gritted teeth, Mr. Speaker, of course, because you see, he congratulates us for this year's economic performance, which demonstrates that 3 years of his performance as leader of the opposition has been based on a false perspective, namely that the economy was going to fail the minute that the election happened. Right? So what did he do? He recognizes that he's been wrong for 3 years, but he says, oh, but this year I'm going to be right, and comes back to his mantra of us not being prudent and we're about to run out of money, etc., which is what he's been saying since he took over the leader of the opposition. Well, it was a figure. I'm not telling the story of Santa Claus, because he doesn't want to be known as the person who wanted to kill his father Christmas. I'm not going to tell him the Christmas carol, because I'm sure that the only person who will feel characterized by Scrooge on that side is not him, Mr. Speaker. But I'm going to tell him the story about the boy who cried wolf, because he's been crying wolf now for so many years that we're going to run out of money, and that he has now recognized through gritted teeth that the performance of the economy for the year ended on the 31st of March 2016 was magnificent. So he has to accept that at least in financial years, 12-13, 13-14, 14-15, 15-16, he got it wrong. Well, he could say, well, chap, you know what? We have no choice now. That's how it's going to last. Even a clock that's broken is right at least twice a day, let's stick with it. Well, in this situation, Mr. Speaker, the clock won't ever be righter than that. Last year, Mr. Speaker, to set things in context, and I'll come back to this issue later on, last year, the whole debate was not just about we're about to bankrupt Gibraltar, and honourable members who were not here last year, who'd be excused for not listening into a whole budget debate if they were busy doing other things, would care to go back and read the handouts, Mr. Speaker. They'll see that the accusation was that we were about to bankrupt Gibraltar. The Honourable Members felt that they were a moment away from a general election, and scaring people was the only way that they thought that they could produce the vote. I think last Monsters University, and any of the members obviously have seen that fantastic cartoon, where the monsters scare children, the children's screams are what produces the energy, and in that way the monsters bow their university. And Mr. Speaker, the scaring didn't work, Mr. Speaker. But they were not just scaring on the financial side. Last year we had probably the most acrimonious debate in respect to the appropriation bill over the issue of whether or not we were going to blow up Gibraltar. The CIA on this side, the elephant in the room, Mr. Speaker, haven't forgotten that last year the accusation was true. It was two prongs, Mr. Speaker. On the one hand, we were going to bankrupt Gibraltar, and this would be seen the minute that the election was over and the real numbers were there. And on the other hand, Mr. Speaker, we were going to blow up, in one of the moments of greatest gusto that I saw the Honourable Leader of the Republican Television pointing to one of his shots with the Honourable the SS Controller on the speaker. They were pointing to most of the north side of Gibraltar, the northwestern side of Gibraltar, being potentially erased from the map. Now, Mr. Speaker, I know that they lost the election. I know they lost the election. Well, it's interesting, but they something. They're really good leaders. But Mr. Speaker, we haven't heard them say for one moment after the election that there was a danger with the LNG plant in the power station. I commend them for it, Mr. Speaker, because it demonstrates that they knew that they were wrong throughout the process and they were only saying that. Because obviously, Mr. Speaker, if it were true that we were going to deal after Gibraltar, the debate is not white clean, even if 7 out of 10 Gibraltarians rejected them. Even if 7 out of 10 Gibraltarians, I would have expected, Mr. Speaker, that there would have been 6 at least of members of the opposition chained to the gates of the new power station. Look! Because Mr. Speaker, I'm a parent. If I, or John Cortez, or any other member of this side of the House believe that they in government were about to install a plant that was going to potentially blow up all of the northwest face of Gibraltar, whether I was elected or even if I was completely rejected and left out of the 3 who fall off for the time being elected, if I was keep on running Robert Baskerville or Chris White, that wouldn't matter to me. I would still chain myself to the gate to stop the responsibility of bringing to Gibraltar a plant that would blow up the northwest thing. And so, Mr. Speaker, they either haven't got the courage of their conviction, or they never have their conviction, which they have demonstrated, Mr. Speaker, that 7 months, 8 months after the election, all of those in saying for God. But I will come back to that later. And, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Leader of the Opposition wanted in his address to, well, assume he'd written, at least he must have had the pressure to write both, but I don't know to him, Mr. Speaker. He either had written a speech that said, I can't believe Mr. Picardo is going to tell us he's going to deliver on his manifesto commitment, if I recommitted myself to that. Or the other one would say, I can't believe Mr. Picardo has said he will not deliver on his manifesto commitment. He should never have won the election because he never intended to do that. I would have thought he would have written both. I would have thought he would have written both. He delivered the first one. I can't believe that Mr. Picardo is going to permit himself to deliver his manifesto commitment. He should not have done so before the time to pause and reflect, although I see that he's adopted my language of pause and reflect in an interview with the fantastic Daily Panorama that I've read today. Or at least you think about the work interview phase. It wasn't suggesting that the Panorama reporter has put words in his mouth, something which I'm sure would not be the case. But anyway, okay. Of course, the problem he had was that I said that we would be looking constantly at the performance of the economy to determine what we could and could not do. But I think, Mr. Speaker, that what will become evident during the course of my response is that the 5 others didn't get the memo. Because you see, whereas Mr. Speaker went on television to say, I cannot believe it, this evening, so he committed himself to his manifesto commitment, we were then treated to 5 speeches telling us that it was dreadful that we hadn't yet completed our manifesto commitment. Never mind the fact that we're only 6 months in. So I think that Mr. Speaker, what must have happened, that DOC had coordinated, appears that there was an element of disarray there since the Honourable Lady left their ranks. He must have given them the speech saying, had a debate, pushed them on their manifesto commitment, gone home, taken better advice, and been told, prepare to tell him that he shouldn't comply with his manifesto commitment. And then he forgot to press send on the email telling the others to change back. Because as we will see, this has been a budget debate where the opposition contributions have been inherently contradictory in per se, in a way that I have never seen in this house. I've never seen it in this house. But that's what happens if you
because there isn't any difference. What happens if there isn't any
difference? There are more reasons that we're going to stop the project, and it's not the really my best feeling. John Crosbeck said, Brooks has got an issue with the third place treatment plant, it's an issue of relation, where are we, the Brexit, or Daniel Peterson said, that's not enough. It's not enough to just pause in respect of the waste treatment plant. He said this, Mr. Speaker, from page 9, Mr. Speaker. Indeed, the DSSC Liberal government has announced that the sewage plant will be personalised in order to save funds in the event of a full Brexit, while adopting measures that would encourage start-up on the rocks with more than 5 employees. But the DSSC leader feels more needs to be done. More needs to be done. So it's not enough that we put the sewage treatment plant tonight. And yet, the Honourable VA Staff of Control, Mr. Hammond, despise Mr. Goodell in respect of the sewage treatment plant. He said it should be done, it should be a priority for the firm. Mr. Speaker, I cannot understand how it is that two people who sit so close to each other don't coordinate their messages. I just cannot understand it. And then Mr. Speaker, who were subject to complaints about job cuts and bills for rental for the elderly, and where's the theatre? Well, Mr. Speaker, it seems to me that the Honourable Opposition Party is not singing from the same hymn sheet as him. We're not doing enough, according to him, for putting this in treatment plant on ice. And yet the others are saying that we're not doing enough because we must complete an overview. It's a very good thing too that one of the first things I do when I get into the office every morning is to read Panorama. It's a very good thing too, because I'm going to come back to some of the things that the Honourable Gentleman has said there to demonstrate just how out of kilter most of their contributions are with each other. But in any event, Mr. Speaker, didn't they all hear the consistent message from this side of the House, which is that we are constantly reviewing where we're going because of Brexit, not for any other reason. But it is really, Mr. Speaker, it is really quite something to see how much joined up the other side is and how the goalposts moved from contributor to contributor, the goalposts were moving. And I think it is clear to me in the context of the contribution of the Honourable Leader of the Division, but you don't understand how the commutation of pensions works. And you were suggesting that if we weren't doing that, if we were doing it out of government somehow, better results would be yielded. Well, Mr. Speaker, he's wrong on both sides. First of all, the government still pays for the finance company limited the amount of the pensions that we would have paid the individual who commuted. So there's no slashing of the government account in that respect. The pensions are paid, even by in the context of a pensioner who has commuted, in the same way as they would have if that person had not commuted. But of course, they are paid by assignment of the pensioner to credit finance. He gave him a copy of the assignment, Mr. Speaker. Now, Mr. Speaker, we had a very detailed debate about how, nonetheless, the account might be slotted in a small amount in the context of not having to pay the 25% commutations that might have been paid before. We can go back and read it because we had a sensible, reasonable, careful debate where we dealt with every penny of the business in the context of the presence today here of the Honourable, the former Chief Minister, who understood the issue and then accepted how it was being done. It was a sensible debate. In the same way, we had a sensible debate with the then adventure in the context of LNG and risk and de-risking, a very sensible debate, which I think really helped people to understand what the issues were and clarified the cloud that the Honourable Members were creating. But I think it also gives me to understand how the community care issue works and why there's an amount is given by the government in respect to community care and why the surplus is also given. So that the total amount given this year is in the context of £27 million,
But the court is committed to everyone not able in any particular year to pay the household cost allowance. It would have, and the government were not able to contribute, it would have the treatment for which to pay. That's why, in part, it's a rainy day fund. But then, Mr. Speaker, he got up to his writing, and I think the only bit that he had done in his speech, although I wasn't sure that I thought he was reading it, was his analysis of the indicator has not been a rainy day fund. And here again, Mr. Speaker, his analysis lacks complete consistency. I'll explain to him in ways that he can understand why that is the case. You see, he says, I'm with Botanic. Botanic created the rainy day fund before 1996, and that's what he would have wanted to be doing now. And look at you, you're throwing money away. Because, of course, the reality is not a rainy day fund. It's not accessible. Well, Mr. Speaker, doesn't he know that the rainy day fund that he throws away in the context of this argument? I know that he doesn't like to listen to you, Mr. Speaker, but this is actually an important thing for him to understand. But he throws away in the context of this analysis are the rainy day funds, the Obama created before 1996, which were community care, which were the reserve of the savings bank. Of course, as we got the reserve, the sinking funds for payment of debt, which the GSC got rid of. And Mr. Speaker, even before the Honourable Mr. Clinton, who I'll come to in a moment, was in this House to recommend that we should bring it back to the Honourable Mr. Speaker, these were all the rainbow funds which the Honourable Leader of the Opposition nostalgically referred to. They're the rainy day funds, which are back today, and the ones which people don't say, but they're not really rainy day funds. They're the ones that Botana has, not the ones that Picaldo has today. And look, Picaldo has the benefit of having, thank God, someone like Botana next to him to help to understand these issues and to create the same rainy day fund. So if he wants to enjoy the benefit of some luster, 396 of the GSOP, he has to realize it's the same luster that shines on us today as GSOP liberals in respect of those people. And Mr. Speaker, the £300 loan, as they like to call it, mortgage, as they like to call it, a financing arrangement, which they now appear to be gearing up to say is the worst thing since sliced bread. The worst thing since sliced bread is freedom. Well, look, they really must think that the people of Gibraltar are very stupid indeed. And I have so much more respect for voters, Mr. Speaker. I think that voters here have the most analytical eye in Western Europe, if not the world. And they see through things, Mr. Speaker. They see through gas clouds that ignite and blow up northwestern districts. They see through threats of bankruptcy, Mr. Speaker. And they see through the idea that this is the worst possible thing. Because you see, Mr. Speaker, when you say to people, you see, we've created this financing arrangement, we've raised this money, and I come to the detail of it in a minute when I answer Mr. Clinton. I give the detail, Mr. Speaker, that I gave already, which is more detail than we would ever have got from the other side. As an alternative to selling it off. Because the state of policy of members of it when they were here, and I know that they don't like your speech, but I'll come to that too, Mr. Speaker. Because there are two of them who were here, two of them who were doing these things from these benches. They were going to sell off every single post-war apartment that the government of Gibraltar had, including the ones at Mid Harbour. Every single one. They were going to alienate ownership of those assets from the people of Gibraltar and leave them forever. The other members have to realize that they said something that I'm going to remind them of. For the next 3.5 years, mercilessly, they think that this is going to be an issue they can use in the general election. They said, we're mortgaging the family of silver. Well, Mr. Speaker, you know what we're doing. If that's where the crisis is not, at least we're keeping the family of silver. They were going to sell the family of silver for less and never have recourse to it again.
was we get to keep the family silver in the family. Everybody in the family gets to use it, and we raise cash for the community against it. A much, much better deal by any analysis. By any analysis. So, when they come to analyze the transaction, Mr. Speaker, they need to remember, and put it in the context, that GST policy was to sell those assets. To sell those assets. It was, in any event, retaining the responsibility to maintain them for 12 years. Mr. Speaker, I don't think McAlver would have thought much of that, Mr. Speaker, when he was pulling out his pencil to do his winterizing. And then, Mr. Speaker, I heard the Honourable Member for the Business Service, he has distorted the accounts of the government. You know, he distorted the accounts, well, Mr. Speaker. I try my best to do my job to the best of my ability every minute of the waiting day. My job is to minister, my job is Minister of Finance, my job is to take all my ministerial responsibilities, and my job as a son, husband, and father. The one thing he knows, Mr. Speaker, that I would never claim to be, is the person who puts together the estimate book. I didn't put together the estimate book, Mr. Speaker. And when Gable Farmer was Minister of Finance, Mr. Minister, he didn't put together the estimate book, Mr. Speaker. We have professionals in the Ministry of Finance and in the Treasury who put together the estimate book, who give us the numbers. So, Mr. Speaker, any allegations that there has been a distortion of the numbers in this book is a gross allegation against the professionalism of the men and women, the professional men and women who work for the government and these departments. And, Mr. Speaker, on their behalf, I deprecate it. They do not deserve it. And, Mr. Speaker, in the context of what we were going on to talk about, he has to remember as well, in terms of the cost of doing business in Gibraltar, that one of his electoral commitments was that he was going to meet the subsidy in a respectable electricity and water. And it went down like a lead balloon when he explained it as one of his key commitments at the GSSB question and answer session. Because, of course, the cost of doing business in Gibraltar would go prohibitively through the roof. At the moment, before the new energy facility is completed with the systems we have in place today, if we were not to subsidize electricity and water, we would probably lose most of the businesses that we have, the international businesses that we have, if we charge the full amount of producing electricity and water in the context of the oil prices that they have been and the hedge that we have. So when we want to talk about the cost of doing business in the world, Mr. Speaker, I was mercilessly reminded of what businesses would be paying in respect of the electricity and water if we had put a foot into convent place, Mr. Speaker. Other than by invitation of mine for a few moments and in a very ring-fenced capacity. So, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has given this interview to Panorama, where he has put out in some way what the message that he wants his budget address to be remembered for. He said the media, Mr. Speaker, talking about the increase in GDP to debt ratio under the law, the media is the same thing, Mr. Speaker, and is now in huge financial difficulties. The Honourable Mr. Clinton called the Bermudians our cousins, Mr. Putin said this. Wishing, they say, that borrowing would have remained at 80% of current income, as has been the case on the rock before the coalition came into office. Wishing that borrowing would have remained at 80% of current income, as has been the case on the rock before the coalition came into office. And if you see that, the current borrowing is current income is £590 million. 80% of that is £456 million. Net debt is £350 million. We are well below 80%
of current-to-current revenue, well below 80%. With the coalition in power, I gave them a calculator, Mr. Speaker, in an act of supreme political generosity 2 years ago, Mr. Speaker, who needs to use it more often. Because you see, Mr. Speaker, with income at closer to 450 million and net debt at 520 million, in net debt terms, when we took over, the GOP were nowhere near 80%. Even if you went to gross debt at 447, Mr. Speaker, even if you went to gross debt at 447, 456 is above that. So we're well below, in gross and net debt terms, 80% of current income. Mr. Speaker, the leader of the panorama will not be pleased to have seen the wall, or the attempt to have the wall pulled over their eyes in this way. I'm sure they, with their calculators, will be able to do the math more easily than he does. But, Mr. Speaker, it's not true that the GOP is advocating austerity measures which would lead Gibraltar into a recession. Well, Mr. Speaker, I don't know where he gets that from. It's clear that he wants to cut spending and not deliver manifesto commitments. It's austerity, Mr. Speaker. Full stop. He's been advocating it before Brexit, before the Conservative Party won the 2010 general election in the United Kingdom in a referendum with even on the card. He's been advocating austerity since he became leader of the party, Mr. Speaker. Totally contrary to the position that the former Chief Minister has advocated. We don't have information about the £400 million in community care. Now, in credit finance. Now they don't want to tell us more about the £300 million that they borrowed. The younger gentleman needs to understand that he, as leader of the party, went to a general election arguing in the area, bankruptcy, explosion, raising the debt limit to £900 million. Or is it that they have forgotten? Their argument in the general election was we will take the debt up to £900 million. And then we will pay it down from there. £900 million. Mr. Speaker, look, I don't see what it is. I don't see what it is that now makes them concerned. Because in the context of the information that we give them, of what credit finance does, which we don't have to give them, but we give them, they can see how much credit finance is loaning to third parties, which is part of creating income, it's a business. They can see how much is doing in respect to conversations, and I'll do with more detail in respect to conversations in a moment, answering the situation. They can see that, Mr. Speaker. They can see what our plans are to reduce debt. They can see what the ratios are. But, Mr. Speaker, look, to say in November 2015, we're going to put the public debt of Gibraltar up to £900 million. And to now say, there's a problem with the borrowing, it's really true, to be inherently self-contradictory. And Mr. Clinton, Mr. Speaker, said that he didn't want to talk about the past. Well, to be honest, it's really quite incredible that a shadow spokesperson for Heritage doesn't want to talk about the past. It's really quite incredible, Mr. Speaker. But I'm not surprised, Mr. Speaker. I'm not surprised that this is happening in the convention, and we're speaking less Mr. Phillips, who's saying a pretty peak during question time. We're not here to defend anyone's record. The past is the past, he said, Mr. Speaker. But look, the attitude that history will teach us nothing is very dangerous indeed, and it's not one that the community is going to accept being duped into by members of it. Of course, what they have disclosed by saying that is that they realize that their political party, the GOP's political party, for which they will remain answerable in this House, whilst they have Mr. Peter Hill, Mr. Hoyle here, who are vestiges
of the European government, and therefore answerable for its actions, is littered with so many political problems that they would rather not be referred to. Well, let me do that. He wants to talk about preserving things today, but he doesn't want to talk about the great destruction of the road at all. Mr. Figure, I suppose, that this is the sort of thing that none of the leader of the opposition needs to say to me was a Clinton moment. Because he spent much of the last 4 years saying to me that the overall industry was having a Clinton moment. Well, Mr. Figure, I suppose it is what he meant. I didn't quite work out what it was, Mr. Figure. Mr. Figure, we have disclosed credit finances balance sheet, and we will disclose it monthly. And in respect of the financing, the £300 million financing, we have disclosed that in a speech by the Chief Minister at the first sitting of Parliament after the transaction was closed. And both of them are things that the law does not require to disclose, but we're disclosing them. So where is the secrecy and the lack of transparency that Honourable Members want to talk about? But what about the things that we found out, Mr. Speaker, only after we were elected? What about those? What about those? What about the way that the balance sheet was dressed up before 2011, Mr. Speaker? But the terrible principles, Mr. Speaker, brought me in mind of that fantastic model of divinity. And how McAlver used to work alongside the YRP. With his cloying humility, his insincerity, and his snake-like attitude. That is the description of the character in the novel. That is the description of the novel. And Mr. Speaker, all of that was said by the Honourable Mr. Clinton in the context, he said, of surplus is getting smaller as we go forward. Mr. Speaker, look. He, of all people, I thought, understood the book, but he clearly doesn't. He, of all people, could have looked back and seen that this is the third highest surplus in history. And at the time to demonstrate it, and to say, zero, I'll go through the details of that in a minute, it's absolutely ridiculous, because that happens in every single year. And we have extinguished most, if not all, of the GST surpluses. Most, if not all, of the GST surpluses. So, Mr. Speaker, we have to compare life with life. And the third highest surplus in our history, especially at this moment, is something to throw about, Mr. Speaker, not something to demonstrate. And I'll show him as well why it's not dressed up. Because we are not in Bermuda, Mr. Speaker, a people who I am wanting, who I respect, and who I work with, Mr. Speaker. They have their own issues and they have their own advantages. And we have our own issues and our own advantages, Mr. Speaker. And all comparisons are odious. But Mr. Speaker, to get up in this house and to say, how can we trust that these budget surpluses are not actually hidden deficits? Other surpluses, we all agree with that all government expenses have payments being slowed down before the 31st of March. Mr. Speaker, do you think that the job of Chief Minister entails receiving the bill, checking them through, stamping the press, and say, pay not before the 1st of April so that my surplus is dressed up? Don't you really think that? Don't you think that the people who work for the government of Gibraltar, aka the people who work for Gibraltar, would allow a Chief Minister, this one or the one before? Or the one before the one before? Or the one before the one before the one before? Mr. Speaker. To dress up the account and to pretend that a deficit if they said this, because that is the worst sort of insult that you know you can level to people who work with numbers and who do their job so seriously. And it is beneath him, Mr. Speaker. It is beneath him. And I'm sure, Mr. Speaker, that next year, when he comes back to this debate, at last with an element of experience, with 1 year's experience in dealing with public finance, he has all the experience that he likes as an accountant and as a banker, but he has zero experience of public finance, he will not level that sort of accusation against the people who have done fantastic hard work for the building, Mr. Speaker.
in credit. I think the people he wants to pick on his prayership and talk to us about how we must do less and there must be less merriment and there must be less spending on frivolity. Well, this is bigger. Can we send the memo to those who are arguing that we could be spending money on dog parks and on theatres? It seems to me that they are not really in the same party. It seems to me, of all the things that we could be talking about in the context of Brexit and the challenges our community is facing, the adequacy of dog toilets is not something I think is top of the agenda, Mr. Speaker. But I'll come to that in a few minutes. And the other gentleman would say, well, how is the power station going to be built and how is it going to be paid for? Again, the mortal sin of writing one's speech before one hears what is going to be said, because we have already had an explanation in that respect. But I guess it's a rookie error in his statement that the Honourable Member of the Opposition doesn't have the benefit of being able to train a rookie error. Which he does, Mr. Speaker, because he is a rookie. Completely when it comes to public finances, as he has demonstrated and been at pains to demonstrate in the way that he addressed this house. The power station, at last the power station came up. How are we going to deal with it? We need to go back and see where we were last year in this debate. The things that are being said in this house. In fact, Mr. Speaker, honourable members might recall that I had to adjourn the debate in this House last year. I had to leave here to have a meeting with the director of Spark in my office. It was really not the circumstances in which I wanted to be in. We had had repeated, unexplained power cuts. If one thing is not a power cut, it's quite another to have an unexplained power cut, Mr. Speaker. Quite another. I'll be as careful as I want to be and not as careful as you want me to be. Unexplained power cuts, Mr. Speaker, something that the community has never suffered before. And has not, by the way, ever suffered again once Spark has been out of the equation. I had to adjourn and go to meet the director of Spark. One of the professionals who asked for the government to go to industry and who said to the government that we have never in this community, in our 50th power generation, experienced power cuts like the ones that we've experienced with Spark, which are unexplained. Of course, there have been power cuts before. The other thing, when somebody goes through a main cable, you have a power cut, but you know what it is, you fix the cable. But unexplained power cuts, it has never happened in our history before. I had to go to my office to meet with the director of the But I want to inform the House of Speaker what happened in the context of that meeting, given that I have to leave the House to have the meeting. Mr. Speaker, I wish I'd recorded that meeting so I could play back to the honourable member here. I wish I'd recorded it so I could literally press play and let the people of the court hear what happened in that meeting. I met with Vladimir Korsin and Damien Cahill, Mr. Speaker, and this is so important. I told them, Mr. Speaker, that I could be a very good friend in good times and a very, very bad enemy to have in bad times. I told them that they'd lie to my face about the commissioning of the Lloyd's Register report. They should have been free to commission whatever report they wanted. It didn't matter for the government. But it was really quite something to lie to the face of a chief minister, especially about something that was becoming so politically relevant and which was at the core of the issues that were affecting our nation in the last few years. I told you that Mr. Cahill in particular sat in my office a week before and told you that he hadn't been responsible for the commissioning of the report. And I hadn't shared it with the GSC, who we had no contact with, Mr. Speaker. And I told him that people who lie to my face are people I never trust again. Something which I commend to every member of this House, Mr. Speaker, in the interest of the people of the region, because we've been very serious with you here. I feel like I got up in front of the whole Parliament to suspend the budget debate, something that had never happened in the history, to explain to the people of the region that the report which had been drafted by the opposition as a report which was independent was actually prepared for them, for Spark, one of the parties seeking to have a power station. A failed bidder in respect of LNG fuel in Gibraltar, and a failed bidder for a power station in Gibraltar. I told him to speak, I had the financial secretary with me, who controlled payments,
the Attorney General, who deals with prosecutions, and the people who are in charge of the prosecutions, they have no other issue with me, Peter. That fine man who was in charge of the GEA as chief executive until that time. I reminded him that Section 413 of the Gibraltar Crimes Act makes him punishable by 5 years imprisonment to waste the divert electricity, Mr. Speaker. And by the way, Mr. Speaker, I tested this with a good element of exclusion, Mr. Speaker, as you can imagine. I told him, Mr. Speaker, if it came to my attention in the slightest, the name of the power cuts that we had suffered in Gibraltar over the past 4 weeks of our responsibility, and which had been brought about intentionally, and if they didn't tell me about it, then I would make sure that the government laid a complaint, Mr. Speaker, through the Attorney General to prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law. And I said, Mr. Speaker, I hope that they understood that and what that means. And I told them I was looking at them, because in Bishop Ahilas in particular, because he was the one who lied to me. He came to the office of the Chief Minister of Gibraltar City, and he lied to me, to my face. And that nobody should want to get away with lying to the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker. Nobody should get away with lying for stop, but certainly not to the elected representative of the people of Gibraltar. And I told them if I find out that they've endangered our community, and if they've interfered with critical national infrastructure, I would make sure that the government would be responsible for pursuing them to the full extent of the law, Mr. Speaker. How do members do today? But if it hadn't been because the Honourable Minister knew responsibility was particularly careful with those who advised him at the time who were, as usual, totally responsible, we could have had a power cut during Calentita when a number of thousand people are in Casenet and its environment, with children, with young people, with open fires. But we took care, Mr. Speaker, and we put specific generators to power Calentita. And quote, and behold, Mr. Speaker, no sooner had the sun go down and the dark come, the patriots lost power from the spark run. They would have endangered, Mr. Speaker, hundreds of lives. But we took care, Mr. Speaker, to ensure that that did not happen. That is why, Mr. Speaker, I was so annoyed, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the people of Gibraltar. I told him that was their last chance to explain the reality of what had happened, and that they'd better accept that from me. And that I've got confirmation from Lloyd's Register of what was happening, Mr. Speaker. I really wish, Mr. Speaker, I had recorded that meeting and was able to play to the people of the day. I told him we need to understand, therefore, where we were in respect of that relationship, Mr. Speaker, between us and Spark. I wanted him to understand what was going. I told him I didn't want any more electricity from Spark for the people of Gibraltar. I wanted it from Energy, who were the supplier that provided it, because I no longer trusted them. I told them I wouldn't take £1 million from them if they gave it to me now to maintain that relationship. It was a complete breakdown of trust. It was a relationship that was no longer worth having. And I told them that that breakdown of the relationship between us, which I've expressed to them in sanctions terms, with the odd exclusive here and there, would be pursued in writing by those of the government's officers or lawyers who were able to pursue it in writing in the appropriate way. And I told them they would never have anything to do with any government organization I was involved with ever, because they needed to understand how I felt, Mr. Speaker. And that the people who were responsible for running the Gibraltar's affairs would be in touch with them in respect of the termination of that agreement of my own to the right. My office is the future. Mr. Speaker, since then, and since the relationship with Spark is terminated, we have not had any unexplained power cuts in Gibraltar. We have power cuts. Somebody pointed it through a main cable in Naval Ground, which connects north and south. But we knew what it was, Mr. Speaker. And so did the poor fellow who went through the cable, as you can imagine. But nothing unexplained. And I'm sure, Mr. Speaker, that the people of Gibraltar would have felt exactly as I felt in respect of that matter. But if we get lucky, we are now in a much, much happier place. Power stations under construction, energy is providing reliable electricity in the context of the period, and if there was a power cut, we know why it's happening and we have to do it. Although electricity generation is always a complex thing, and you can never state some exact science and anything could happen at any time. So, Mr. Clinton, when you raise
power. And the cost of the power, you need to go to the power station, just to put in context of where we were, not just there, but where we were under the GST. With a power station that was going to cost £440 million, with a loan that was going to be financed off balance sheet, that was to him seem such an offence and sin. And yet, to the greatest libertarian of all time, their former leader, the man who threw him out of Europe for having the temerity to read the new people, or the man who, when he challenged his reading the new people, he had the gumption to walk out on, because a right riveting reader did. He wanted to do the 140 million of fancy. That's what we were letting ourselves in for. And he supported the GST in that general election, Mr. Speaker. But it wasn't just a borrowing of balance sheet through a government company. It was a borrowing of balance sheet with a 5% per annum escalator in the consumer's electricity charge to go up 100% from where we were in 20 years. And 100% increase in the cost of doing business in Gibraltar in terms of the electricity bill, and 100% increase in the cost to every homeowner in Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker. That's the off-balance sheet transaction that they were planned. And that's what we want for the respect of power. Not where we are today with the 55 million payable over 10 years without the need for a commitment to raise electricity prices from where they are in respect of subsidies, which is where they put us. He says that we need bigger rainy day funds than the ones that we have today. Well, what does he think of? He needs to understand that the rainy day fund today is bigger than the rainy day fund that we inherited. Community care was at zero. The savings fund reserve was at zero, Mr. Speaker. The rainy day fund was not there. We turned up, Mr. Speaker, to find in number 6 Cumberland Place a little kidney that had had a hammer put through it. And nothing left, with an memo inside from a very worried financial secretary saying, the clock is ticking, 28 million left. That was their rainy day fund. He might as well, the Honourable the Greatest of the all time, might as well have left me a note saying, sorry, there's no money left. Which at least is what it is reputed one junior Treasury Minister in the last Labour government did to his successor. In the president. But Mr. Speaker, to say that we need a sinking fund to repay debt, etc., and to admit that we have one really quite something to somebody who purports to be aware of the numbers, Mr. Speaker. And I think he was very disappointed because he just delivered the easy speech, Mr. Speaker. He delivered a speech about the hair shirt, about spending less, about austerity, I'm the one who will save, you know, I'm the huge rich for me in these difficult times. It was the easy speech, Mr. Speaker. And I'm afraid, Mr. Speaker, because I have known him for many years, but I think he let himself down considerably, especially in the eyes of those in this community who expected him to do a better analysis. Mr. Speaker, he asked about the context of the increases in government rent and how those were related to capital assets. He needs to understand that minimum wage did not exist in 1984. It was a measure introduced by Mr. Bolsonaro. Another one of the main questions things we've come to this community amongst scholarships, community care, etc., and I'll come to that in a minute, really, if it happens to them. But the minimum wage, introduced in 1988, by the first year of the administration. In 1984, with a weekly salary of £126 a week, based on a 5-day week and an 8-hour day, the minimum wage was about £3.15 to today's £6.28. That's an 100% increase. Let alone the 340% increase in average salary from 126 to 555. And in respect of the people who we are working with in relation to the transaction, I gave them the name, Babson and M&G, for example. But M&G is one of the largest financial institutions involved in property finance in the world. I sometimes see him with his having lunch with his very friend, the Financial Times, Mr. Speaker. Well, look, M&G were on the front page of the Financial Times on Wednesday or on Tuesday. A banking is even bigger, probably the largest, one of the largest property funds in the world, managing approximately 20 billion, if not more. And so we're paying much more than the base rate of the Bank of England, 0.5%. We haven't done a good deal. I think instead of quoting Apple, in the Powerbank, he should have quoted to us from David Copperfield. He should have quoted to us from a tale of two cities, Mr. Speaker. Because they seem to live in one and we seem to live in another. They live in the one where we can't make ends meet and any day the whole edifice is going to crumble. And we live in the one where we're doing careful financial planning, getting the best products in for this community, spreading it over the longest period of time, which is what he as a banker would know is the safest and best thing to do. But what he as a politician is saying is mortgaging generations to the future. Okay. That is, he knows, irresponsible. And I would ask him if he wants to be taken seriously, as he believes he should be taken seriously, so he needs to act responsibly in the narrative that he does in respect of these issues. Otherwise, Mr. Speaker, he is not going to be favorably characterized as the man who says far humbug in respect of every spending. Another Dickensian character who I mentioned earlier. Because he can talk about saving and about not spending unnecessarily and the growth of the public sector. If he moves his chair slightly to his left and sits next to the Honourable Lady with that, but he cannot sit in the same political grouping that went to a general election promising to undo the housing work agency agreement, which has cost millions of pounds in terms of the extra packages, so from two out, one in, to say that you are going to bring them all back and send even more millions back, and so that you're looking at how we save pounds, shillings, and pence. Because you're either saying, I didn't agree with the leader, I was a part of my history, or we were saying it for the sake of saying it, for the sake of trying to group them into voting for us, but we had no intention whatsoever of delivering it. It's either one or the other, Mr. Speaker. I mean, there is one, Mr. Speaker. It's not unfunny to think of him as fruit and to think of the Honourable Lady of the Division running around after Father Christmas trying to cut his head off, which is what he himself said on Newswatch, he felt he was doing it. The people said, I feel like I'm the man trying to kill Father Christmas. Well, they don't make for a happy Christmas carol to be sent to speaker. Well, then, speaker, I must say that the criticisms in respect of the music festival were so politically naive that I thought that he would have better now. Because, of course, I saw Mr. Keaton enjoying it last year. I saw him have usual convivial conversations with Mr. Hammond there last year. I think I saw Mr. Ray was there last year. Mr. Bettino was there with us last year. But if there's one thing which is absolutely true and the Honourable Mr. Leonardo has already said it, we really do spend most of the time working there rather than doing anything else. I spend most of my time glad-handing members of international boards of gaming companies and financial services companies, talking to them about the rock, dealing with issues, making notes, sending notes, testing. Let alone the analysis the Honourable Mr. Leonardo did of how the income proposal is generated, what the business plan is like, and how we deal with it, and I think some potentially even more exciting announcements in respect of that going forward, Mr. Speaker. But anyway, it's so easy to put our hair straight on, Mr. Speaker. And I wonder if he would assist me with a nod or shake of his head. But I do recall, of course, not from the government's bill, but I've spoken there last year. I'm sure you did, Mr. Speaker, because I didn't invite him. But he was there, Mr. Speaker. You see, I just wondered, Mr. Speaker, I just wondered whether he wasn't going against the festival because he just doesn't want to go.
whether I don't know, the government and I live in charge for many years, and I have some jealousy of categorizing as a sort of person who would mastermind to the discussion of subjects the operators Wagner rather than the Spice Girls and any of the acts that are coming this year. Although, given the views of these cabinets of the Heritage, perhaps the mastermind, as you said, how much do you know, chaired by the legendary Charles Hunt? So it may be the figure who just doesn't want to come to the music festival and doesn't like the music, but look, there are other ways of doing that instead of trying to persuade everybody not to come. Because we have to do a job to give it. There'll be lots of MPs and MEPs there, there'll be lots of gaming companies there, lots of insurance companies there, so I think we should reconsider his position. There is a job of work to be done there, and I ask him to join us and bring that job of work. Because otherwise, what he's going to demonstrate is that, as we often used to be told by the greatest Gibraltarian of all time, Mr. Speaker, that he knows the cost of everything but the value of nothing, Mr. Speaker. Every time we attack the huge spending that we were seeing from ordinary members, we were told, oh, this lot of the bribe, you know the cost of everything but the value of nothing, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, what we're doing is growing Gibraltar. And this nitpicking, and trying to find issues where there are none, is not going to help Gibraltar grow. And the Honourable Gentleman surely must understand these things. And if you were not there and you were here, Mr. Speaker, with me, with Joseph Farmer, with Albert Menner, with my ministerial team, he would know, as he knows today, but of course it's not politically extreme to say, that we're doing exactly the right thing. We're doing exactly the right thing. This is how we are building an empire. Mr. Speaker, you see, you can be very pen-wise and very pound-foolish if you are not careful. And if you need to be heard from that pen-wise and pound-foolish action, you're happy as a partner in working together across the floor of the House and if you defend the interests of the community. So the one thing to say is, what is the exact price of the panel that the DOJ and the DOJ are purchasing is not, Mr. Speaker, because that is not going to take this community forward. It is important to understand the price of panel. It's important to get panel for the best value for the taxpayer, but there are some very good people who help us with that. He is not a person who is devoid of talent. But I think he has demonstrated that he is devoid of judgment in the way that he has approached this appropriation debate. He's really taken the attitude of just the bookkeeper, Mr. Speaker. I work with many accountants, and I work with many bankers, and I work with many economists, and they are not boring dream accountants. Many of them are imaginative, and they point to things that can be achieved and how they can be more self-financing. To take the attitude of a junior bookkeeper, Mr. Speaker, is not going to assist them in this House, and it's not going to assist us to do the job of governing the opposition that we need to do together. Mr. Speaker, people don't elect bookkeepers, they employ them. People don't need to go for an election to elect a bookkeeper. You know, people have driven, people who understand what the community is saying, but they know how to take that community forward in the context of the public finance available, of course. But they know how to save money and not waste money, of course. But not a question of election bookkeeping. Because you see, if that were the case, Mr. Speaker, and if that were what his party should be, what would he have done as bookkeeper to Peter Everard's £9 million hole in the ground of the Theatre Royal? What would he have done? As bookkeeper and Minister for Heritage, as I assume he would have been in that government, I would have thought he would have been completely apoplectic. He destroyed the Heritage assets and it cost £9 million for nothing. Those are the labels that are here, dear Mr. Speaker, GSD. Those are the labels. Forget the word tax now. £9 million to destroy Heritage assets like the Theatre Royal. Or, Mr. Speaker, if he was a junior bookkeeper who was told, here is the project for the new airport, £24 million, to have the project manager come back with the bill,
£84 million.
£84 million, a £60 million overspend on one project. How does he feel as a member of the GOP who supported the party in the election before and after that debacle, Mr. Speaker, with his bookkeeping view? What about the legislature? The legislature cost £9 million just to demolish and prepare walls, Mr. Speaker, let alone the additional cost of preparing it. It leads to the midtown, which we'll come back to in a minute, because we've had accusations about us stolen land, Mr. Speaker. The deal of the midtown did not go out to tender, by the way. It was just done, and the premium was paid by the £10 million of preparation of the legislature. When are we ever going to get the £9 million from the legislature back? Never. But it's a prized asset, an important asset for this community, for families, for later. Damon Speaker, as bookkeeper for the GSP, how he feels about those things, Mr. Speaker. We won't get anywhere, because that would be the other 1970s colonial bookkeeper, Mr. Speaker. We won't get anywhere. Because this community has moved on, Mr. Speaker, from people who did some for our colonial masters at the Dutch. Although I must say, Mr. Speaker, I would have had to go on a greater length in respect of the independent contribution if it wasn't for Mr. Foster's and Mr. Foster's magnificent way of dealing with it. But let me just deal with one particular issue. There's very little evidence that you are a transparent government, Mr. Speaker. In the context of the government, the record of which he defended and defends, we are positively secret. I'm going to come to some of the things that we found out when we were elected, Mr. Speaker, to demonstrate even just how secret we are. You're all thinking of the of window dressing, Mr. Speaker. Window dressing by curtailing spending before the 31st of March. Now, if we don't curtail spending, we're spendthrift. If we curtail spending, we're trying to dress things up. Or it's austerity. You see, by curtailing spending, it's austerity which they said they weren't going to do. The public can see that it's an obvious silly trap. The sky is deficit, spending, pending bills hanging over. As Mr. Begala lost control and he hasn't got through, he said. So, Mr. Begala, doesn't the honourable gentleman realise that if I had to be doing that, if all of the public offices in Gibraltar have responsibility for the account of Gibraltar, were to hook themselves to me and allow me to control themselves and say for that to happen, and if I had done it in the first year, and the second year, and in the third year, in the fourth year, in the fifth year, where would I be now? I would have had to keep retaining 3/4 of bills. My payment would be a year and a quarter out. But you realize, therefore, that it might be for him his first appropriation session of this house. It might be for him his first estimate book, but it's our fit as a government. If you have been holding bills over, if that was our way of doing things, it would have caught up with us by now. The surpluses would have been affected. That's why I'd be declaring the third lowest surplus in our history, not the third highest surplus in our history. Could have taken £25 million in another way, but I accepted the advice from the first moment I was elected to take £25 million out to give to the companies to deal with the issue that we inherited in the companies when we were elected. If I hadn't taken £25 million out, I'd be declaring the highest surplus in the history of this nation. This is not a disguised surplus, Mr. Speaker. A disguised deficit, sorry. This is not a disguised deficit, as the Honourable Gentleman has purported to suggest. At this careful and difficult time of our history, he comes to this House and instead of praising the economic performance of the country, he didn't the position did with Wicked Tea. He says, could this be a disguised deficit? What signal does he think he's sending the rest of the world about the economic stability of the Gibraltar? It's obvious. but so serious. This is not a dressed-up deficit. This is an understated surplus. An understated surplus, which is the 25 million extra, would have been the highest surplus in the history of our nation. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I am informed by the Treasury that prior to the last year end, the Treasury had its usual flurry of payments, not a withheld payment, of payments. This is the argument about whether spending is done in the third quarter, the fourth quarter, which has to be done, or unnecessary spending. But there's a flurry of spending, so there's a control, but there was a usual flurry of payments that have to be made before the end of the financial year. So it's actually quite the opposite. There is pressure for things to be paid before the end of the financial year, not after the end of the financial year. But then again, there is the inexperience in respect of matters of public finance. It doesn't understand that, Mr. Speaker. And so, Mr. Speaker, that this year, the actual Treasury set a record for payment outflows processed in the period, which was above their monthly target for payments. In fact, even though payments not decelerated, payments were accelerated, and we still declared the third highest surplus in the history of our nation, and without the 25 million, the highest surplus ever in the history of our nation. So you might care, Mr. Speaker, to send a signal to the world that whether he is GOP or GOP or Liberal Party, he doesn't believe that Gibraltar is a place where the estimates book, where the public finances are fiddled with in a way that is best to mislead the world. And that actually, our public finances are spent. Because that is the best message we could send the world today, not the message we purported to send. If any invoice has been held up for payment, and there may be one or two, it may be because some invoices are challenged. We really want us to pay invoices which are to be challenged if we don't accept an invoice simply because we should be paying before the end of the financial year. You should be saying to us, no doubt, of course, if you want to challenge an invoice, you challenge it in the usual way. But I'm assuming that in a recent meeting with the executive board of one of the largest building companies that was building in Gibraltar, which is not just a building company, it was put to me, and it's something of which we should be very, very proud indeed, that the government of Gibraltar and the government of Germany are the only governments that this company deals with that pay in 30 days. And that everywhere else, they find it difficult to get payments in 180 days, even when invoices are accepted. So the community doesn't have public finances where surpluses may be masqueraded as surpluses, as the Honourable Member purported to suggest, to endanger our economic stability. Is that analysis that I've tried? This community has a public finances that are able to pay on the nail like only Germany does, in respect of the experience of the board of directors of this particular company. Something to be sincerely proud of. But if the financial secretary or any controlling officer is questioning an invoice, they are absolutely right to do so, and I have my full support in doing so. But anyway, if there are payments which are going to spread over the financial year, for example, if an invoice comes in late in March, provision is made for it in the account in the following year. And you can see that, for example, in the IMDA. I'm left with the impression that, in fact, the only thing in the context of the House's debate on this bill, which is window dressed, was his statement, Mr. Speaker, because actually the numbers demonstrate just how healthy our public finances are. Mr. Speaker, we saw earlier in the analysis how the Honourable Lord of the Opposition has said that we should be pausing and reflecting, to put my language, in respect of manifest commitment, but we should not be committing ourselves to wherever accepted, and how others are saying something different. But Mr. Speaker, I would have thought at least that for my mind, peacefully from the outside, at least, considered to be the top of his team, they might have got the message right.
Clinton went on to chastise the Honourable Mr. Cortez for the failure to finish the establishment of graphic with the number of castles, which on Monday they denigrate and on another day they write, and then to question why the dementia facility is not open and the dental care facility is not open. And when are we going to do the 1,000 low cost housing units, which are now manifesting? Which is it? Do you want us to do them? Do you not want us to do them? I really don't understand what side they're on, Mr. Speaker, or whether it is, Mr. Speaker, that actually behind the veil of the GOC, there are divisions that one can't even imagine from the outside, Mr. Speaker, because certainly they seem to be beginning from an entirely separate committee. The Liberal Mr. Speaker, I think that we should have a comprehensive debt management plan, Mr. Speaker. It would be very good advice indeed, Mr. Speaker, to rationalize our debt and to have a comprehensive management plan, debt management plan. I think it would be very good advice if it wasn't what we already have and if it wasn't obvious, Mr. Speaker. If it didn't suggest, in simply in advising us, that none of the professionals who work with the government would not already have in place with the government a comprehensive debt management plan to rationalize debt. Now, Mr. Speaker, he might have thought that as a GOC supporter, knowing that the GOC got rid of the sinking fund to pay debt, but with an eye to the estimate, he should have spotted that fund is back and that we're in the process of rationalizing debt and having a comprehensive debt management plan. So I'm surprised that he didn't give us advice, and it's obvious that we are already implementing. You can see that our job on this side of the House is to govern, to ensure that this community progresses, to ensure that we take this country around where it needs to be. Then, of course, it's opposing to question, but it's not to throw pebbles and to talk about lack of transparency where there is complete transparency. Where there is, for example, in relation to community care, then what we do is we give them on a monthly basis the numbers, Mr. Speaker. We put them online. At the first meeting of the South, after we've done the 300 million transaction, I've come and talked about it. At the first meeting of the South, where we've done the public power station deal, I've come and talked about it, the 55 million. But what a difference, Mr. Speaker, on the question of 300 million institutional investment in integration. The approach of members of it would be approach from the market. Because in the market, Mr. Speaker, all we have had is sincere congratulations for having been able to close such a transaction. It closed in May, Mr. Speaker, the last day of May, to close such a transaction with the Brexit vote winning. That transaction would not happen today. The risk built in to the cost of interest over 30 years would probably be 20 basis points higher now, probably closer to 6%, 5.85 from 3.85. That's why, if he was not where he was sitting now, if he was where he used to be sitting before, he would have picked up the phone, he would have called Albert Mayer, he would have called Peter Mondolito, and he would have congratulated them for having done an absolutely excellent deal for the people of Gibraltar. Not mortgaging to future generations, but assuring the future of future generations. Not selling the family silver, retaining the family silver. There has to be something wrong, he says, if you can go and borrow 300 million without asking my permission first. But he says, absolute nonsense, Mr. Speaker. He wants to rewrite the rules of the South. He wants to rewrite the rules of public financing, not just for the world, but for most of Europe. To come here before we do, look at the obligation of the regime in relation to government financing, to lay on the table after it's done. This is not government financing, this is government company financing. There is no obligation. And yet he gets the information, which he has scribbled down deeply. He has scribbled down the dates in which I saw in the computer, Mr. Speaker. He's got the information. So what is he telling about? He's pretending, as they were spending up 3.5 years, pretending and complaining that there was a lack of transparency where there was absolute clarity, Mr. Speaker. Absolute clarity. Mr. Speaker, all of that
the context of the 300 million, the context of the 55 million for the power station, all of that has been brought to the House in the context of that illustration. And the first meeting of the House after the transactions have completed, Mr. Speaker. Is that what they would have done? I ask myself, is that what they would have done, Mr. Speaker? Well, Mr. Speaker, of course that the Honourable Mr. Clinton doesn't want to talk about history. Of course, Mr. Phillips doesn't want to defend anybody's record, because that is what they did not do when they were in government. We weren't told about the deal to mortgage all of the car park. We weren't told about the deal to give 1% of the £1 billion transaction to a particular company that was close to the former administration in breach of European Union rules. In fact, we were not even told that there was advice that there was in breach of European Union rules. We knew because I'd raised in the House that it was. And the Honourable Performer to make, I didn't want to answer. But he asked us, why weren't we told that the estate were being sunk into companies? He suggested that we should have come to the House and defended that and explained to the House why government estates were being put into companies and at what price have they been put into companies. He wanted to know, have they gone in at nil value? Mr. Speaker, the government estate has been put into companies at nil value by the DOD. Not by us. And we know, not because we were told in this House, but because we found out after we were elected. So I can understand why Mr. Clinton doesn't want to defend Mr. Keating's record in government, why Mr. Phillips doesn't want to defend Mr. Hayes' record in government, because their record in government is of having done all the things that he condemned during the course of his speech, having put government estates into companies at no value without the permission of the House and without informing the House. So neither before it was done to seek consent, neither after to seek to inform. So, Mr. Speaker, I hope you know a little more of what this party was actually and of the initiative which he currently defends in this House actually represents. If he wants to make the point that he's making, shuffle up a little to the left, abandon the initial that represents everything that I have just gone through, and stand for the things that he is pretending to stand for. And then there's a big one who says that looking at the Bank of England base and looking at the 3.85, nobody can say that the 3.85 is the best rate going. That really is believable. That really is big, and he knows exactly why it is. That is, of all the shots he took, the cheapest shot he took, he knows it was a cheap shot, he knows it was taxpayer. And you get the honor of the part of the country. And the banker remained with experience. He led one of the top banks in Gibraltar. He knows the speaker that the overnight lending rate of the Bank of England is not the lending rate available for 30 years. But if he doesn't know that, Mr. Speaker, and with the Bank of England rate at 0.5% today as it was when they were last in administration, he needs to explain to me how 3.85 is not a good deal when all they got when they mortgaged the car parks and the Bank of England rate was exactly the same as it is today, 0.5, they got 7%. 7%. Well, Mr. Speaker, and to think that Mr. Speaker calls him a guru. I think I have been unfortunately able to demonstrate that he's gone from a high financier to an effective colonial bookkeeper in an hour analysis. And I'm not going to give him, Mr. Speaker, every balance sheet of every management account of every payment that the government does at the end of every month. Because we are not here to give the management account of the government. No company does that. You see that the shareholders in Gibraltar PLC, who all of us represent,
who all of us represent, would not want to see the management account of this company. And if you were a company, they would not be entitled to see the management account of the company. But nonetheless, we're going to give them a million times more information than they ever gave us when we were in evidence. And if you think in respect to credit finance, which we used to invest in development, then we understand when they're criticizing the communication. So they understand, rather, when they're criticizing the communication. But if you criticize credit finance, and communications are part of credit finance, don't they understand what you're thinking? But the honorable gentleman to my left, if you get the honorable gentleman to my left, is always on the left. He doesn't change, interesting. Has created in credit finance, in respect of the communication, one of the most ingenious and positive things that could have happened to this community. Because when the honorable, the former chief minister was here, he used to say, one of the biggest problems that we have in Gibraltar is the pension scheme of the civil service. After 16 years in government, the last thing he did was end it. And there was no longer controversy as to whether it would also end for honorable members opposite the final salary scheme. But in credit finance, the honorable Mr. Bassano, through the payment of commutation, has given people what they want in commutation of that pension on a formula, I think, of 12. We've seen the documentation. But the course isn't done. Because the government keeps paying the pension. He's created a new kitty, a new sinking fund. Because credit finance keeps getting that money. But honorable members of the people just don't understand it. They don't see the ingenuity, they don't see the benefit. I think from the debate we had, that the honorable Mr. Gavana did see it by the end. Absolutely understood it, Mr. Speaker. And if they care to please be careful and analyze things in a way that is appropriate, they too would understand it and understand just how good it is in the context of open-ended final salary scheme and increased life expectancy. People can now live 30, 40, 50 years on their government pension. And yet, everybody's very happy to take their communication, a large number of them are very happy to take their communication, invest it for themselves, have control of their own destiny. That gets rid of a huge problem. I mean, if you take a piece instead of listening to me, I won't bother to explain it to you, Mr. Speaker, because this is really important. But that gets rid of a huge problem for the exchequer in a way that is ingenious and creates a long-term benefit for Gibraltar, both for the person taking the conversation and for the government of Gibraltar. And just for that, Joe Bassano deserves huge recognition, except that there is so much more. That brilliant idea, which deals with such a thrilling problem, will probably be a footnote compared to everything else that we say about him going forward, which is even more deserving of praise. And Mr. Speaker, the fact that credit finance has given loans is a very good thing too. Because credit finance is managing the money in the savings bank. And we have to pay interest to the depositors in the savings bank. Because not Instagram, Valvan, Osano, Picardo, Garcia, Costa, Sacramento, Cortez, and another social retail. Because the GDP in 2008, when the Bank of England rate came down, said we would pay 5% to our pensioners and lower amounts to others so that we insulate this community from the big problem that there is in the context of savings and income from savings. We would give 5% to our pensioners, which we have honoured. We've lowered the other rate, but we've honoured that. Okay? Now, the reasonable gentleman knows how that was paid before. I did a very careful analysis of this in my budget speech last year. We look at it, so they did all the ratios. But it was paid out of taxpayers' money. Out of taxpayers' money. The taxpayer literally put his hand in his pocket. You give me £10, I, tax
chair will give you the interest on it, on a government bond, which we can spread to the savings bank. The top chair was paying for that 5% in effect of the cost of borrowing from pensioners and government bonds. The savings bank, where we have transferred the product, is going out and trying to make the money work to pay the interest rate. So we always charge more than we pay so that the money works for us. Now, this is an area where we don't have experience. This is banking. When the concept of banking is born, when the Medici and the Rothschilds start the business, they don't take money for people and put it in a safe. They take money from people to lend to Paul and to feed. There can be moral issues with this. It's called usury as well. But it's modern banking. And what we're doing in that way, is guaranteeing further the future of our pensioners, because we are making a turn on the money, ensuring we can pay them, and if we ever have to put our hands in our pockets, that's what the savings bank says we have to do. But then put the hands in their pockets every month to pay the interest. The taxpayer is paying the interest every month, Mr. Speaker. If, as a banker, unless he didn't just leave the profession, he also decided to turn it back on his principles, he must be telling us if we're doing the right thing. No financial institution would ever take £100 from somebody, put them in a safe, and from its own resources, pay them 5% interest. He would take the money, put it to work, and use that to pay an interest. Mr. Speaker, and in terms of credit finance, that's what credit finance is doing with $17 million. You see from the breakdown. Loans, credit finance, loans. And then the other round, the commutation. And if the money's going, a part of the money is going into what is happening with Gibraltar Investment Holdings, and so, why aren't we seeing these accounts? I recognize that we haven't yet filed the account, but you cannot pretend not to understand why. You can't pretend not to understand why. When they were in government, the party that he currently sits with was in government, the initiative that he currently defends were in government, they stopped filing the account. They stopped filing them. Now, we need to rebuild those accounts because we have to go back. What does everyone know if they didn't rebuild the account? So it's not difficult. But if you're having to go back, you can't even see the accounts if you haven't done the accounts 10 years ago because it's a cumulative process. Anyway. But I hope that this has resolved some of this concern. But if you might care to look at what Sajid Javid has said this week, also on the front page, page 2 of his very friend, where he's asked for the United Kingdom to have a fund of between £100 and £150 billion to grow Britain in the period of instability and expected growth of Britain. And I better understand why it was absolutely right to ensure that we were able to have investment in Gibraltar looking forward. On top 3,000 to speak a little bit, this is extraordinarily clear. And speaker, these are not refunds that the government is holding back in any way. And in fact, the head, and this applies to the person wearing the lady ring, the head is not in there before. There's been money for payment, but we've added the head, and we've added the largest amount ever given to that head to repay. But it's not true to say that people at the income tax office want to repay this money, and the government doesn't give them enough to repay. This requires a lot of work to do, Mr. Speaker. And that process is being undergone. And it's not a question of window dressing. As I said, I'm not going to keep anybody's money. I would quite happily give it up as soon as we are able to, in a proper and rational way, in keeping with the advice that we have from the tax office, Mr. Speaker. But we are in a much better position than we were, Mr. Speaker, when the opposite was true, which members of the which clearly will also not defend.
when the taxpayer you owed a much larger amount. And so, Mr. Speaker, I think you have started in the process of saying that, that this is a window dressing, I think, was really to suggest that we were trying to hide the gist of our accounts, and that is a much deprecated, a much deprecated allegation of symbolism. So, Mr. Speaker, in the context of the company account, the other gentleman will allow me to say that even if they don't want to go back and look at history, even if they don't want to go back and learn the lessons of history, we are not going to allow them to go away from the reality of what they did when they were in government. Because the general public does want to learn from history. The general public does want to understand what the GOC stands for. And the general public will want to look at what the GOC says in opposition versus what it does in government. And you see, Speaker, those of us who have memories like elephants remember that in 1996, the GOC was elected on a ticket of getting away from government companies and doing what they called the Red, publishing all the accounts of the government companies. And when they were elected, Mr. Speaker, they made the Red company bigger than it ever had been before. The company started to trade, which they had never done before, they just made assets, and they failed to publish the accounts of the company. So they don't want to look back at history, Mr. Speaker. We will ensure that the people of Gibraltar realize that the GOC says one thing in opposition and then promptly goes and does the complete opposite in government, Mr. Speaker. And while he sits with the GOC, that is the record with which his contributions will be accepted and through the spectacle through which he will see every contribution that he makes. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Hammond started by saying that parking had never recovered from the loss of parking at Commonwealth Park. So, Mr. Speaker, the ugly, pharaonic project costing £15 million that he described the magnificent new Midtown coach and car park doesn't provide 255 spaces for the Honourable Gentleman. Well, no. But that's what he said, we've never recovered from the loss of Commonwealth Park, although the park is lovely. And Mr. Figueroa, who used to sit there, used to say exactly the same thing. I'm against the park, but I'm in favour of the park. Because people love the park, so I don't want to be the person who's against the park. I love the park, but I wish I could park there. Well, Mr. Speaker, despite that nonsense that he has tried to perpetuate, because you're either in favour of the park or you're against the park. The idea that parking has never recovered from the loss of Commonwealth Park, 355 spaces lost, might have been something he could have written when he started to think about what he was going to say the morning after he was elected in November. But it was something he could have struck out of his book before he came to the House to think. And not something an argument about, well, one of us may be right and one of us may be wrong, Mr. Speaker. On this, I am going to be claiming to be speaking from what was St. Peter's said. Right? Because the answer is empirical. I'm going to take it from another paper. There were 342 spaces in the place known as Commonwealth Park now. There were 233 spaces at the Naval Grounds. There is a car park in the Naval Ground on the southern side of the Naval Ground. There were 47 places at Wellington Front, and there were 369 places at the Eagle House Makano car park. That much criticized car park that the GOC insisted they were going to demolish the first day after the 96th election, and which we demolished last year. Another thing to put in your list of things that GOC say versus things that GOC do. Did you get those numbers? I'm assuming that you did. It's 991. Can I just remind you, Mr. Speaker, that of those 991, in a deal that never saw the light of day, in an annexation of land which was never put to
to tender or to expressions of interest, which is the Midtown deal, Gibraltar would have lost the 369 car parking spaces at the Midtown, at the Meccano car park. 369, 991 minus 369, 62. We would have lost, additionally, the 45 at Wellington Sun, because the DOD project at Wellington Sun also included no parking. 62 minus 47, 575. And we would have lost the 233 at the Naval Ground as well, as part of the secret Midtown deal, which was not advertising and involved in annexation of land, which was not put to tender. 575 minus 232, 342. 342, the speaker. So, Gibraltar would have been left under the GSD with 342 parking spaces, because Midtown would have parking, but it was going to be private pay parking. I don't know whether he's understood what I told him, Mr. Speaker, but if he goes backwards, what I've done is, Mr. Speaker, I've demonstrated to him that the 342 spaces at Commonwealth Park, where Commonwealth Park happily now is, are all the parking spaces that were going to be left. Now, but you know how many parking spaces there are at the magnificent Midtown station car park? 1,041, Mr. Speaker. 1,041. Of which, 715 are totally free for residents of Gibraltar. I think that, I mean, in political terms, it doesn't get worse than to attempt to make the calculation of the honourable gentleman attempted to make. Because he said that we had never recovered from the loss of 355 car parking spaces. I'm not including there the car parking spaces at Pullman Island that we now have, which we recovered. I'm not including there the number of parking spaces that were at the King's Wharf, and speak of that is now going back into private hands. We were using it whilst we were building Brendan, whilst we were building the Midtown. And wait for them to see, maybe it's worse. Because there's huge pressure. I don't know whether he's on the list, but people wanted to sell them more of the parking and rent some of those parking to the people who live in the area of Edinburgh House, who, of course, were the people who were having to fight for parking spaces around. The people who the GST would have left with 342 parking spaces. So, Mr. Speaker, everything else that he says, which is empirical, in particular in relation to having a complex or particular matter, has to be seen in the context of the way that he has failed to do his math on car parking spaces. He was an easy one, I don't know why he did it. But the one thing I'm not going to do with him, Mr. Speaker, is to try and establish fastness in the Parliament, Mr. Speaker. I think this Parliament needs to be looking at other things in greater detail than establishing fastness for behaviour. But what I will not accept, Mr. Speaker, is any suggestion from him that the government is playing fast and loose with public money. That is one of the most serious allegations leveled across the floor of this House, Mr. Speaker. Fast and loose with public money. I don't know whether the honourable gentleman opens his mouth and says things he doesn't know the meaning of. But if he does, Mr. Speaker, then there is a very serious allegation indeed. Because if anybody was playing fast and loose with public money, it was the party, the initials of which he currently represents in this House, that did a deal to give somebody 1% of a £1 billion transaction without going to tender, without going to expressions of interest. It's the government, Mr. Speaker, that is he defends the record of in this House, that alienated the whole of the naval ground without going to expressions of interest, without going to tender in respect of the Midtown. And that is playing fast and loose with public money. Breaching EU rules, Mr. Speaker, and having legal advice that told them they were breaching EU rules. That is absolutely a disgraceful playing fast and loose with public money. Not, Mr. Speaker, selling buses that you can only sell to people with a specific type of license for the maximum that you can sell. Or whether he thinks that we didn't want to make more money from those buses. Israel didn't hear or read the questions that Rabble, Mr. Oran, had forced at the time that he raised. Why did he just want to play politics and say things that sound bad and hope that some people believe them? If he doesn't speak, he'll find that the vote of Israel are such a cute analyst of what their politicians say to them that he's going to be toast sooner than he thought. But to accuse those who were involved in the development of the Midtown project, of the Midtown Party, of poor project execution, really hits a new low. It hits a new low in respect of the magnificent work done for this community by Gibraltar Drone and Building Services, a company that the person sitting next to tries to break once in a while, a company that the former chief minister went during the course of a general election campaign in breach of every rule of the book, and gave a pay rise, a 60% pay rise in the middle of an election campaign. This is what they did. And yet now the GSP has said, by the mouth of Trevor Hammond, they are responsible for poor project execution. I will make sure that the directors of GJBS understand what gives you of their ability to deliver a project here. But the course, they didn't work alone. They didn't work alone, Mr. Speaker. They worked also with the group that was involved in developing the Midtown, that was involved in delivering King of Four. The group to which the GSB granted Coney Island, also outside of a tender process, as a swap for King's Wharf. The group, Mr. Speaker, whose project execution the GSB and therefore he thought was so magnificent that they gave them without procurement, a 1% deal, on a £1 billion transaction. A £1 billion transaction. And he says that group are responsible for poor project execution. My goodness, that's playing fast and loose with public money when they were in government, or fast and loose with people's reputations today and not caring what he says about people's professional reputation, or fast and loose with his own reputation, because nobody, I think, would be able to recover from having said something as magnificently irresponsible as that. And then he accuses us, Mr. Speaker, of a piecemeal attitude to resurfacing. I must say that I am shocked that he has once again not bothered to go and look at the numbers. Because, Mr. Speaker, if honourable members care to do their homework, with all the publicly available information that there is in the Library of Parliament here, Mr. Speaker, they would be able to see how much has been spent on highway maintenance and resurfacing in every year, at least going back to 1995-1996. Right? So our piecemeal approach to resurfacing has produced £5.3 million of investment in the past 4 years, not including this one. The former administration spent £5.2 million, less money, in the 4 years before, and £3.3 in the 4 years before. It's about £1 point something million a year. Except, of course, for the years in which least money ever was spent in resurfacing. 1997-1998, when they spent only £31,000, 2004-2005, when they spent £308,000, or 2005-2006, when they spent £468,000. Speaker, the people of Gibraltar are paying him £34,000 a year, not to come here and say what he likes, but to do his work, to research, and to not make allegations which are completely unsustainable, and to at least get out his abacus and count how many partners there are to realize that he cannot make allegations that less is being invested now because less was invested when they were there, and to understand whose reputation he is shredding with the allegations that he is making. Because in the end, Mr. Speaker, it's his own.
the idea to figure out we are creating a concrete jungle into this. Because of the way that Queensway is developing, is also quite fantastical, Mr. Speaker. Doesn't he remember that the development of the area of Euro Towers was approved under them, and that we have people, children, approaching us in tears because they were going to lose their car park? Don't you remember that Midtown, which I've now reminded him of, was actually much higher? It was like a needle in the center of town, and it was granted in secret to a consortium, without tender, without expression of interest. And planning permission was given by a secretive DPC that nobody got to look into. Don't you remember that the same is true in respect of King's Wharf? Don't you therefore realize that the concrete jungle that is Queensway was one that they created and that we modified because we brought the pipes down in the context of our negotiation and took away a third of the land that Midtown had? We required that the next King's Wharf tower be lower. And shouldn't we therefore stop trying to mislead people in the way that he has done? Because, Mr. Speaker, to pretend that Rook is the last plot available in Gibraltar for development, and ignore that the largest plot available in Gibraltar for development was Naval Ground, and we at least went out to expressions of interest. We have said to the community what we're going to do. We're negotiating with them. It will have to go to an open DPC. And yet they gifted Midtown without expressing their interest, without tender. And now they complain about what's going there, which is lower than what was there when they approved it. You just carry on opposition. I'm surprised that Sir James doesn't come in now and sit alongside them, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps Barbara Windsor would be a better site. It's not about coming in and criticizing and stifling every plan. It's about doing a careful analysis. You don't come in here and you say the best parking than there ever was because there's a pond and grass where you used to park. You do the calculation, it's all public. It's great for me to say. Mr. Brecky, didn't you hear me say, Mr. Speaker, that we have to build more in this house? We have to build more. Integrator. We have to build more because one of the big issues now is that people will be able to house their employees, the gaming company employees, the insurance company employees. I'm going to be introducing a measure at the end of my address today, Mr. Speaker, to deal with those issues because the House will be very happy to know that I've had more detailed discussions even since I presented the appropriation bill in the first reading. And I'm now minded to bring to this House for approval a new measure, Mr. Speaker, that will be even more advantageous for the growth of Gibraltar and to ensure that the gaming and insurance companies we have here are entirely satisfied that their needs will be taken care of. And Mr. Speaker, in that context, to have heard the Honourable Gentleman say that the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and he has done nothing because his government has done nothing and he's just relying on reports from governments. I think he's thinking he's done his homework because he realized that those government reports were completed before 2011 when we were elected and that the Honourable Minister was the author of them. And his dreadful accusation, therefore, is that Donald Trump is relying on his own work. And then he says that there's no provision in the Improvement and Development Fund for the power station or the storage plant. But I've given a speech saying before how we were going to fund the storage plant. And I've given a speech explaining how much we were going to spend from the IMDF in respect to preparation and infrastructure for the power station. So when you talk about air quality, and I have to choose between his analysis or the analysis of John Cortez, which comes down to interpreting data, given the way that I've demonstrated he is incapable of interpreting even numbers of car parking spaces, on something as important as a particulate matter, I am going to side with Mr. Environment John Cortez. And I'm not going to think he's an abject failure for not having been the one who answered the question on the balloon, because
his position has been clear throughout and has been one of the forces for good in that respect. And neither do I think that Trump has ever lost in his speech, but he's left to look at him to know he knows exactly what he's going to eat. And a good portion of it. And I wish I was there with him, but I'm not allowed anymore. And this is because we haven't finished the most complex re-engineering of Gibraltar's traffic. Doesn't mean that we haven't started, and we haven't had the courage to be the ones who started doing that work, Mr. Speaker. And just because we haven't kept the most extensive cadre of highways enforcement officers that the GOC created, doesn't mean that we're not committed to this and what the faces to be done. And just because residential parking hasn't happened yet, doesn't mean it's not dangerous. But you don't implement one thing unless you're implementing the whole of a holistic plan, which is what we're doing now. And Mr. Speaker, given the analysis that I've done on the number of parking spaces at the Midtown, I think people in the town area, people driving into the town area, and the strategic plan will all benefit hugely from the car park that he delegates, because he knows it's an absolutely magnificent thing, and he has nothing to say about it other than he doesn't like the look of it, Mr. Speaker. And in terms of speed cameras, etc., that is something that is going to happen very quickly. There needs to be an amendment to the Traffic Act that will be happening as soon as possible, and in the autumn, no doubt, we will have that. But to hear him then say that because we don't yet have the speed cameras, we have little regard for public safety, words that rolled off the tongue because that's what he spent most of the first 6 months before the election saying, although he no longer has the damn thing to say about LNG and Shell, it's really quite something. Because I seem to recall that we were the ones who had to get rid of the Kita Multa helmet. We were the ones who had to enforce legislation for the right helmet to be used, not the GOC, who are obviously in a position of little regard for public safety. So it's a figure when another member of the GOC says that the GOC is not designed to score political points. I'm going to be forgiven for at least being skeptical. The Honourable Gentleman knows I was unable to be in the House for his address, but I was able to hear most of it, and I've been able to read most of it. I'm grateful that he sent a copy to the press, which is deviated from the text, and I wasn't looking at a particular time. I may have caught it in mind. But he says that some commentators describe the future job strategy as a Soviet-style employment system. Now, although, of course, Mr. O'Connor would think that that is a very good thing, he wasn't saying it in that way. He was trying to pretend that that was actually a very bad thing. But I'm not going to let him get away, Mr. Speaker, with saying that some commentators describe the future job strategy as a Soviet-style employment system. Now, I don't know whether he knows who the commentator was, because I do. You see, Mr. Speaker, those with memories like Ellison recall that he was not in the GOC at the time, that he was in the PDP at the time, that his leader was then the highly esteemed Mr. Speaker, if I will now, the chairman of the bar, and that he was very deprecated indeed about the man who is now his leader, Mr. Speaker. But of course, it was the man who is now his leader, at least in name, Mr. Putin, who said in the press conference, which they hastily convened to try and undo what was clearly another brilliant suggestion from David Sanner, that this was a Soviet-style employment system. Or maybe it wasn't a debate. Maybe it wasn't a debate. So it is absolutely misleading of the South to come here and to say that some commentators describe the FJS as a Soviet-style employment system. You can say, look, we as your political opponents have described it that way. We because we're now together, before you weren't. You can stand aside from each other politically. But it's not an independent, this is not Daniel Finkel signing in the Times, Mr. Speaker, who has brought an independent mind to the analysis. Come on. Mr. Speaker, maybe he can share with us in one of his sponsored Facebook messages that must cost him a bomb to try and get somewhere near the top of people tweeting him. Who he thinks the commentator was. Well, Mr. Speaker, that sort of and here and there and stab here and stab there. And that sort of thing has not stood people well in the past couple of weeks in English politics. He needs to be careful about to be pretending to say one thing and in practice another. Anyway, how does he explain to people who are now in jobs, who were not in jobs when the GOP was in government, and who are happily in jobs, who have gone from the future job strategy start into full-time employment in the private sector? How do you explain to them that he even now is against the strategy that got them to work? I mean, if he was dying to make this speech in 2011, if he had been elected into a position with us in government and he wanted to hammer the FGF, I would have understood it. The FGF has 5 successful years of operation now. These guys are at work in the private sector, Mr. Speaker. How did he explain this nonsense, Mr. Speaker? Absolutely nothing. In fact, this is an impressive plan which created employment opportunities and which created opportunities in companies in the private sector. The sort of thing he keeps talking about, but which we never see. Because if he is genuine about not wanting to talk with people once and working with us, and if people in companies have approached him to create impressive opportunities, why is it they don't approach us? Or why is it that he can't tell us who they are so that we can take up those impressive opportunities? Because if there are people who are unemployed today who could take advantage of those opportunities, and there aren't many unemployed today, shouldn't he want to help them? Or is he saying to them, wait 3.5 years, I think we'll win the election, and then maybe we can get a job? Because frankly, that would not be a duty of a loyal opposition. No, I think, because it's just nonsense and doublespeak. It's just what can I put in my speech, Mr. Speaker. Of course, one of the things one can always put in one speech is a little bit of bail bail to the Attorney General and to the Chief Justice. I mean, and one in huge good stead if one is in the profession, I imagine. Because, Mr. Speaker, I couldn't come away from the thought that the circumstances that I saw in that speech was really quite dramatic. I never quite heard anything like that. Although Mr. Dunley and Mr. Lammers, who heard all of the praise that he heaped upon them, it was really quite stunning to see how it was being heaped. I just wonder, Mr. Speaker, what is the Honourable Gentleman has standing in court at the moment. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, he encouraged us to have the political courage to raise rent even more, Mr. Speaker. He seems to want to see people pay more, Mr. Speaker. And he means testing. But doesn't he know that there is already a means test, by the way, Mr. Speaker? And all this talk of means testing, doesn't he know that we have something called rent relief that the most deserving in our community already get, Mr. Speaker? The elderly in our community deserve it, get them. Those who cannot pay their rents already get. We do have a means test already to stop those who cannot pay. But look, he encouraged us to put rent up higher. He said it seemed to be going up higher. It's something that has happened. We think that we can do it in a way that is demonstrably not going to affect people's ability to pay like what we're doing now. At the same time as what's happening there is, because everybody should pay, and those who have not paid must pay, and they must pay higher rent to a liable lady, who's doing an absolutely magnificent job in that respect, if I may say so, and a rent up, which is, for example, also the equivalent of having to give up your panorama, something which I recommend people never do, and that they should pay their additional rent and buy their panorama to be able to read the block that one of the leaders of the reproduction was prized. If you get past the journalist, who will no doubt be able to point out that he's not going to have the wall pulled over the people of Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, is a good measure by which to demonstrate that rents are going up, but not in an unaffordable way. And as I said before, Mr. Speaker, the first thing I do every morning is read my panorama, so I certainly would not alienate my purchase of that magnificent newspaper because of the rent. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Lammers said in a much more affable tone that he was not here to answer questions for those who had been here before, and he was not here to shoulder their burden. And that we are not reminded of the history of our party. He must have taken tea breaks at all the appropriate moments, Mr. Speaker, in the short time that he has been here, or not ever listened to Parliament before he was there, Mr. Speaker. But Mr. Speaker, look, I will take at least the affability of his tone and try and return it in this way. Look, all of us care about people with disabilities, all of us. And I'm not going to pretend that people care more or care less, because
Department has brought this a new rigor. People are very happy indeed with our things today. People want more. We want to give more. We have to make sure that we do more in the appropriate way. But when the older government says, this should have been done 10 years ago, and speak of the 6 years of those 10 years, it's the government that wasn't government. It was Mr. Little who he was criticizing. And he said, you know, I've got to show the responsibility. Look, I tell him what I tell Mr. Clinton, what I tell Mr. Phillips, what I tell Mr. Hammond, and what I tell him. Whilst he sits with the GOC, he is infected with the things that they do. Whilst he sits in particular with Mr. Peter and Mr. Vailes, he is infected by the fact that they've got part of the government that did all the things that I'm telling them. I'm giving you some of the things which he says they should do. But I will accept from him that he must have been able to do the calculation that 10 years took him firmly in GOC therapy, and that he was therefore being entirely non-partisan, entirely straight with the community, accepting a criticism of his own side and asking and encouraging us to proceed. But the Honourable Lady, who can be assured, is the strongest advocate for those with disabilities in a government that is already very caring and wants to ensure not just that we give to people, but that we encourage people to do more, not just about handouts, this is about mechanisms for people to be able to do more than that. And that the very ungenerous reference to Sarah Lemon in his introduction is one which really would produce the affability of his term, because even those who, for reasons of wanting to illustrate a point, suggested that the Honourable Minister should have Sarah Lemon, said that in every year that she would be elected, we would have had panics of strawberries for the work that we've done. And I think if only they expect to talk to us about some of the work that is coming, they would have once again visited upon her panics of strawberries, because in the context of that analysis, and for Speaker, for Samantha Sarah, it really should be strawberry fields for her. But he says, Mr. Speaker, in the context of looking at care, that we didn't have people from agencies involved. But I've asked for the statistics so that we understand it. We have 332 people from agencies. This is a number that fluctuates. And some days we have more, some days we have less. The requirements change. We bring people to the hospital, we give them care for a couple of weeks. That care is extended, for material wise, or not extended. But Mr. Speaker, 332 people from agencies. Let's just take a very simple calculation. If we were employing these people in the public sector, as he suggested that we did, for the money that we pay, we could afford about 100. So he's denying 230 people care. So what does it mean? People come to agencies as employed on agency terms that pay private sector rates. We're very comfortable with that. We put the minimum wage up considerably. Since we were elected, I think the minimum wage has gone up by like 15% in the past 4 years, right? But if we don't do it that way, and if we do what the GOC is proposing now, for the money that we have, which they already say is more than we could have spent on everything, we would be able to pay for 100 instead of 332. So that's not a capital calculation. Maybe 150, might be 90, right? But it's about a public sector worker cost is about 3 times what an agency worker costs them. So if you want to spend less, you can't do it, Mr. Speaker. And the problem you're dealing with people's care here. People would lose their care. And, of course, you didn't get the memo from the Honourable Gentleman saying, I'm going to be complaining that they employ too many people in the public sector. Because it's just supposed to be the right to employ more than 332 or at least 100, depending on how he wants to do the analysis on the other. And of course, these are a different bunch of the people who are employed in the public sector. So you've got all the people employed in the public sector who are in all of the areas where we provide care, and an additional 332, because we can afford them, because we can pay for them in the district. And Mr. Speaker, that project itself is not mentioned in my speech because it's in the book, and we will be dealing with it in making announcements when the time comes. And this is like the Care Quality Commission, for example, but that is creating a new public body at a new cost, which involves employing more people and spending more money, Mr. Speaker. And I think if you go to Pittenhill at GMPHQ, you're going to find a memo from the Leader of the Opposition saying, don't suggest employing more people, don't suggest employing spending more money, because I'm going to say they shouldn't deliver on their manifesto commitment and they're spending too much and they're employing too many people. Otherwise, it's all so inherently contradictory that nobody knows
what it is that they stand for, Mr. Speaker. But as he said, as he felt so passionately about the therefore of the commission, in the same way that he said to me, you didn't mention first steps for the kingdom folk, I said back to him, you talk about the therefore of the commission, saying the manifesto. Although I'm grateful to speak that he recognized that good work has been done in the sake of fostering our adoption, which is important work has been done in the community, which has been promoted by the Honourable Lady and the Count, I fully support and encourage. But when it comes to IVF, Mr. Speaker, this really was a thing of this government. It was something that was denied by the former administration, it was brought in by the Honourable Minister for Health, and I don't know whether he meant to recognize that, but if he did, I'm very grateful that he did. When the Honourable Member has said in campaigning mode that the new dawn never happened, I am very, very proud indeed to say, Mr. Speaker, that the new dawn did happen because I've met the new dawn, she's got a name, she's got a surname, and she's running around Main Street now because she's been introduced by the F, and she's not really, and she's just the first one that I've very, very many names. And when it comes to bed shortages in the hospital that need to cancellation of operations, I don't know whether the Honourable Lady has mentioned this, but you have to understand that this doesn't apply to her now because she's moved away from the contagion, but this is still where she has been sicker. You need to understand that they reduced the number of beds in St. Bernard in the move down from Old St. Bernard to New St. Bernard. There was one ward left. The only day that there's a bed missing, I said, they cut the number of beds. And the idea of putting or building an elderly accommodation for the elderly, but in terms of private, is something that we are looking at in detail. But it is not something that can be done publicly. In other words, we cannot now create, in the same way that we create for those in public dormitories, tenancy for the elderly who are in private accommodation. And I see nodding his head in agreement, although of course he doesn't know, as I do, that the GOC made a commitment to house one person in such a home who was going to be allowed to sell his private property and go into one of the government's rented elderly accommodations. Mm-hmm. And he was an ex-GOC minister. I think I was very disappointed when I saw the record. And I told the Honourable Gentleman who it was, but I didn't think it was appropriate to honour that commitment because it was an unfair and inappropriate commitment. And I did not see the report before the election. It was one of the commitments that the former administration I did not honour because I thought it was improper, I thought it was immoral, and I thought it was illegal and outside the law. And I don't think, Mr. Speaker, that a new airport allows for connectivity with other places. I think an apron does, and we have an apron, and we could have gone to other places where they refurbished their terminal, we could have built a different city terminal, we could have built a terminal for £24 million instead of spending the £24 million and spending £84 million on it. And so therefore, Mr. Speaker, he will understand in the context of what I have been saying during the course of this morning that I do not believe that there is a golden GSB age in office, Mr. Speaker, and that in fact there is a golden age coming, it's coming soon under the GSB Liberals. But you know, I don't want to go into the detail of what he said about the bridge and the sidewalk, although I think he will find that it was fairly ungenerous for him to say that they were just lacking gimmicks, Mr. Speaker, and to say that simply because the water for the eighth is dirty, that things are not going well in the upper office. The water is sometimes very clean indeed, but the monkeys dirty themselves because they've jumped in it, Mr. Speaker. And they get up to things that I sometimes have to shield my children's eyes that they are doing to each other in the context of those upper rock bars, Mr. Speaker. But there's one thing that's certainly not going to happen. We're not going to commit destruction of areas. That's why there are already balustrades in the upper rock, in different areas, in new areas. This is something that we have invested in. The neglect that we've seen, the neglect of not one penny invested in the upper rock between 1996 and 2011, and I recognize that he is not suggesting that the concrete happened. But you can see that what happened at the lighthouse was not that John Cortez decided to go and destroy all the plants, but that John Cortez advised that before the 2011 general election, the plants that were being put there did not survive, and lo and behold, at the end of that winter, they were gone. Although I must say that he does not endear himself to me in his analysis of the functioning revenue and the tonnage, because he doesn't understand what he's talking about for this reason. the coming of Jesus Christ has nothing to do with the work that is being done in Gibraltar. It's got to do with other states changing their rules. So we have a lot of German fleets registered in Gibraltar. The Germans have now changed their rules for registration, and German fleets have left Gibraltar, Singapore, and other registries to go back onto the German register. And the bunkers, you can see, are only going in one direction, and that's not. So it doesn't need to think. He said, if the tonnage going to our neighbors across the bay, Aristotle doesn't have a register that's recognized by anyone. These fleets are not going to Aristotle, they're going to Germany. And I think a publishing list is not something that one is now able to do because of paper protection. So he's not going to get a list of who got the vote. But he doesn't need one. Because this is not something that he's given, like the Midtown is given on the file, Mr. Speaker. This is something that is given based on a list, not by ministers, but by people who are officials of the court. And it's something that he can see in broad daylight. He can go and sit there and see who's got the vote. And it's a very convivial place to sit. It's very inviting, in fact. And he can principally recognize he's brought back fishing. It's a lovely place to sit and see who's got the vote. And I don't know if there are friends of mine there, no friends of mine, relatives, no relatives. I don't know who's got the vote. I mean, I get a better indication of this than I get on Facebook, but he doesn't think that we have been directing votes to one or the other. But to say that we should have prioritized St. Martin's over the birth is really quite something from the party that said to the people who represented the children of St. Martin that they were not going to be able to for them at the season. And to say that we should have put the fast launch changes even quicker so that we could have done that in time for the small boat thing and the legislation in the film, doesn't he know that this house hasn't sat for 6 months because of the referendum? Otherwise, all of that could have been done. But he wants the cost of owning a dog to go down and the cost of owning a bird to go up. And if you see that, the reason for that, I'm so transparent, I'm not even going to go further into it. I'm not going to go further into it. But I congratulate him for his footsteps in that respect. And I also congratulate him, Mr. Speaker, for not waiting for the government to install a zip line on the upper rock, for quickly politically mounting it, Boris Johnson style, and letting himself go down the zip line that was his contribution. But well, I think we all look forward to seeing those in the upper rock sooner rather than later. Mr. Speaker, I saw Mr. Hayes in his usual style, his veteran style in the House, play the trick of saying both something and nothing, so that it was very difficult indeed to grasp at the moment of deciding on how to respond. But he did encourage us to complete the stadium for the GFA in one place or another. And of course, something that I don't know whether the Honourable Leader is listening to so keen on, but we're given a disjointed style. I'm happy to see him suggest it. I'm happy to see him suggest it to continue with our plans for the theatre, also against the background of the Honourable Leader of the opposition, suggesting the increasing line of Mr. Gritman. But I thought it was a little brave of him to complain about works done in people's houses and how those works might in some instances require a correction, when in fact, when we arrived, we inherited thousands of changing jobs. People have been working in some instances 5 years, 10 years for a change of shutter. 10 years! The years we've been past 16! 10 years! Now we're down to almost no waiting. We do thousands of jobs, some of them need correcting. Well, fair enough. And we do no jobs, none of them need correcting. That's absolutely clear, Mr. Speaker. And I've made the point on the Housing Works Agency, so I'm not going to make it again, Mr. Speaker. And I'm grateful that he was generous in his congratulations of the Honourable Lady for her correction of arrears. I think it's absolutely right that she should be congratulated for the work that she has done. But I don't think it's right to be concerned about allocations. The allocations have now been made, the way that we've done them is entirely in keeping with the rules and with the commitment that we gave in our manifesto, that we would prioritise those who are on the waiting list in 2000 2011, at the time that we were elected, and he encouraged us to build more emphasis. And I have to pause there because that is an important aspect that Mr. Hill has touched upon, and it deals with issues raised by the leadership of the position by Mr. Phillips and by Mr. Clinton. We were told to build more rental homes because not everybody can afford to buy. Mr. Phillips said something slightly different about people being forced to buy if they can buy and not being given rental homes. But of course, all of this is in the lexicon of understanding of the GSC, which would be selling all of the post-war properties. That's where they were. They were going to sell all of the post-war properties and build new properties for rental. So what we've done, Mr. Speaker, is we build new properties for rental by the elderly, which moves them out of their existing post-war properties, frees them up for new families to use, and we're keeping all our post-war properties with the excellent finance arrangements that we have done. And I wanted to understand that because I think of all the people that contributed in respect to this debate, he's the one who is usually fairer in his analysis, and if he's understood the point, I think he will be with me on it. We'll take the point relating to the minor snagging suggested in respect to future comparisons. No doubt we'll have to look at that. Nothing compared to what we've been in the case before, but look, this is an issue of the fix or government, and what there has to be is a commitment to fix the things that go wrong with the developer for itself. And if he says that there are issues affecting people who have had the new family and establishment in the estate, if he was so kind as to write them and tell me who they are, to one of the ladies, he will immediately pursue those, because we have, of course, complaints about work not being finished. Everybody wants things done quickly on their block first, but it's sometimes very difficult to ensure that. And of course, what we have is the happiness then when it's done, we're not being told that there is water in this where there wasn't, we can tell that, then we can ensure that we look into it. I move now on, Mr. Speaker, from the official opposition to the Honourable Lady, who is in the community, and now shadows all portfolios, not just those which have been entrusted to her by her former leader, Mr. Speaker. This really started by reminding us all rightly that we should congratulate the Lincoln Football Club for their magnificent success in qualifying for the second round of the Champions League. And I think all of us on this side of the House want to join her in doing that. I think they have really done Gibraltar proud. This is only the beginning of, I think, the work that the boys can do in football. As you understand, obviously, the things that they do in Scotland. And I want to make clear, because it appears that from what the leader of the said in Panorama today, that he hasn't quite understood the point, that this is only one potential solution for us going forward, and that we must explore all potential solutions going forward. And Mr. Speaker, I'm reminded by a veteran of the DFA, a veteran player of the DFA, Honourable the Minister for Justice, although I didn't know the results, but he wrote to us, who also qualified yesterday for the second round of the Europa League, Mr. Speaker, that we've been in with the name of in 15 years, we're already in the second round, in 15 years, the Champions League of the Europa League will be in Gibraltar for 15 years. Is not this year, and she spoke of the association of this place with democracy, and she also works with one to associate myself with. I thought she rose above the partisan debate at the beginning of her address, and she talked about how Gibraltar will thrive, we were able to work together as a community. I talked about this being an extraordinary people doing an extraordinary thing, and I think she captured what I was trying to say in that respect. So he told me that he was going to write to me about some concerns that citizens have. But as she knows, when I receive her communications, I will be dealing with them in respect to the history of lifts which have not been installed. One of the issues that we have is that to install lifts, we need to put in something called three-phase electricity. That is taking longer than getting the lifts set. And that is also an issue that makes it impossible to install lifts in an affordable way in some states. And indeed, some of the building and the architecture of some states make it impossible to install lifts in some blocks. Frankfurt is actually one of the ones where a lift will be installed, and it's just a question of getting enough people to install three phases in the other states which are ongoing, to then install three phases in Frankfurt and then be able to get effect to the lift. But we can't do everything at the same time, we only live in Israel a finite resource. We could bring great people in from around the world so that at the same time we can put three phases into everything, it would then all be done in a week, it would all then cost a huge amount of money, and it would not be in the interest of the community. We all agree on this side of the House. The property needs to get upkeep, and the Honourable Minister has Mr. Speaker, the only tenancy we're all going to have in common at the end of the day. And as the honourable lady is much appreciated by the that case is full of people who felt that they were so important to the people. And she's absolutely right to care about them. On the issue of tax areas, I think I've dealt with the questions that she raised in the context of my other addresses, but in PAYE, if somebody doesn't pay PAYE, it's theft, Mr. Speaker. It's a criminal offence. And the specific provision in the law in that respect, and the government is never going to tolerate that, and the commissioner in particular doesn't tolerate that. And some of the problems that isn't the account is sometimes missing with old areas of PAYE, of companies that are in liquidation. This is what we dealt with before, and one of them is blasting accounts, they're dressing them up, this is actually untidying accounts and making them unnecessarily seem to be involved, and that has to be dealt with. In a reasonable city, there's actually a lot more movement. Mr. Speaker, you might think there's a lot of work done, but sometimes the arrears goes up in any of it. Like you're dealing with all the arrears and new arrears coming up, and the arrears are sometimes going to be moved, but we've been very aggressive in that respect with cutting people off, and unfortunately, in some respects, it's the only thing that works. I recognise her welcome in respect to the rent arrears, and her clear view that it should be annual, which I've already said it will be. When she talks about the feedback from the community in respect of the budget, I'm grateful that she's undertaking that work. The honourable deputy commissioner and I were very keen to get the cameras in here to get people to be able to see what is happening. She's right, it's about more than just that, but this is at least the beginning and part of the process. So, well, I heard with interest some of the things that she said. But I looked into it, and she said, we should never even have an act of self-awareness that we need to feed it from women's sanitary. So I looked into who had put them in. I put into what government had introduced them, and I'm sorry to say that it relates to 1998, Mr. Speaker. But I leave it at that, Mr. Speaker. I leave it at that. The other lady called us to publish and include pages which relate to GIH and the accounts of the companies of the government, etc. These are public. They should be even more public than the other lady has suggested. In other words, they should not be public and confidential for 3 months to members of the House. These accounts should be public, and they should be public in the company's registry so that everybody can see them online, Mr. Speaker, as they will be, Mr. Speaker. But of course, when we caught up with the huge delay of the party that used to be infected by created, which means that we're having to recreate accounts and it's cost them a lot of time to be able to do. I think I've given a lot more details now of GCA that people can feel entirely safe, Mr. Speaker, because their homes are not at risk at all. Nobody's home is at risk at all in respect of GCA, which is the issue that's been raised. And I think that would be something that we would be pleased to know given the question that we raised. We haven't turned Manchester commitment into consultation exercises, although if you were sitting on the other side with the other representatives with the GOP, that might have been at least speaking opinion from the Honourable Leader of the Opposition Committee, because we had done that, so I would complain that she was accusing us of something that the Leader of the Opposition was inviting us to do. But actually, in the respect of one of the commitments that she actually wrote or talked about, the commitment was actually to carry out a consultation exercise with the looked at our manifesto. I was grateful, Mr. Speaker, for the mature approach from her that still has recognized the sterling work done by some of the parliamentary and from the staff. But I didn't understand the point that she said that we should bring the things that are in the final book into this book. This book is an estimate, and the final book reflects the agreement of the House to say, Mr. Speaker. The white book, as we sometimes call it, then becomes the blue book, Mr. Speaker, sometimes different colors. And that is the book that is the final account. So, the Honourable Lady will receive a book which is not draft estimates, but government estimates, which is final. I was very heartened to hear Mr. Speaker that she served as an effective opposition to the government, but also as an effective opposition to the opposition in the NSSP, and I salute her independence in that respect. Mr. Speaker, before I move to conclude, I want to announce a new measure as a result of meetings I held this week after coming to this House, and a very positive progress that I believe there will be in the market to build homes for key workers in Gibraltar sooner than I expected. So therefore, I announce a new budget measure today. that where any property is constructed in the next 30 months from the 1st of July 2016, and that property is rented for residential purposes, the owner of that property will receive a tax credit equal to the tax payable on the profit earned on the first 24 months of rent occurring in the first 5 years after the completion of construction of that property. A tax credit is not refundable and can be accepted as a tax payable to a citizen arriving to the tax. Mr. Speaker, this is not just a government of colleagues, this is a government of friends. We understand each other well, we work together well, Mr. Speaker, and that is why we are a team, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps that is what has already caused a fracture to happen on the other side and might in the future cause others, Mr. Speaker. We are not just colleagues, Mr. Speaker, we are friends, we are part of a team. As are the people who work with us, Mr. Speaker, the civil servants of the Georgia who have helped us to deliver these results. The civil servants in particular, Mr. Speaker, who have been so insulted at the Treasury and in the Ministry of Finance with the suggestions that we might be able to prevail upon them to somehow present an untrue picture of the account of the board, Mr. Speaker. They do the work, Mr. Speaker. We are not the masters. We work with them. And as President Jimmy Carter once said at one of his G7 meetings, thank you, Mr. Speaker, to all of them for allowing us to take the credit for their work, Mr. Speaker. I also hope that we will have friendship across the House, Mr. Speaker, and these 4 years, as I said, at the ceremonial opening, Mr. Speaker. Let us not see members opposite adopt a sixth form debating style, as they have in some instances in the course of this debate, which is neither helpful, not edifying, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, if they look at the work that this government has done and this government is doing, and they think at the moment in which Gibraltar finds itself now, they will agree with me that there is no better team to break the next 24 to 36 months, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Albany says he's doing fantastic work in the gaming and financial services industry. He believes he's probably delivered more projects single-handedly in 4 years than any minister with a university, senior schools and a marine, Mr. Speaker. Paul Albany has finally had the courage to seek a wholesale plan in order to deal with the traffic problems around Gibraltar. He's dealt with housing, he has dealt with the port. David Garcia, who is lobbying with me around the world, who is the backbone of my government with him, Mr. Speaker. Neil Costa, who works tirelessly every hour that God sends, that doesn't allow one moment to pass without hard work. Samantha Fernando, who is dealing with tourism, who is dealing with housing, who is dealing with the problem where he is at last, who introduced the first hike in rent in 30 years, Mr. Speaker. John Cortez, Mr. Environment, who is dealing with health like it's never been dealt with before, who is carrying out under him more operations than have ever been carried out before, and seeing another man who introduced the music festival to Gibraltar, the jazz festival, and so much more, Mr. Speaker. Gibraltar is not the place it would be if it wasn't for the team and all of us, Mr. Speaker, building on the work that Joe Buchanan has started in 1988, when it was the first time to turn around Gibraltar's economy when the MOD were leaving Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker. That was a time of great challenge. Who better to have in the team now than Joe Buchanan again to face that challenge? Those who have criticized them, I now sense, are starting to change their attitude. And instead of trying to criticize Joe Buchanan, what they're trying to do is build him up, Mr. Speaker, in some way to try and suggest that those of us who are around him might feel that we are less than him. Well, Mr. Speaker, you know what? We all know that we are less than him. We all know that we are building on the legacy that he has started to build for Gibraltar from the minute that he arrived here in 1972 and started the battle for parity to today, when he is still creating ingenious new funds, ingenious new rainy day funds, exactly the sort of medicine that Gibraltar needs to navigate these difficult red brick waters, Mr. Speaker. These are the teams that Gibraltar needs, Mr. Speaker. I am not one of them, but they are part of the extraordinary people doing extraordinary things, Mr. Speaker. And to only hear petty party criticism from some of the members on the other side is really very, very unedifying. Now is not a time for party political engineering. It's not a time for finish, Speaker. As I said before, this is a time for substance, Mr. Speaker. But unfortunately, that is not what we've got from them, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, instead of joining us tonight, I must say that's also the Honourable Lady. In raising our eyes beyond today, to look out for a common tomorrow, unfortunately, we've seen them looking back to try and replace some of the arguments that lost in the election with the worst people ever suffered by a party in a two-horse race in the history of democracy of today. Mr. Speaker, nothing unfortunately seems to be changing in their approach. More crying wolf, more talking to Gibraltar down, nothing extraordinary, no one extraordinary, Mr. Speaker. Just the same old that the party of which the nation has already rejected. Nothing I've heard, Mr. Speaker, persuades me to do anything other than to commend the Village Left.
And we're going to speak upon our proposed strategy, which is now 4,000.
I have to put the question. I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to appropriate sums of money for the service of the year ending on the 31st day of March 2017 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Honourable the Chief Minister. Sorry, I think the clerk would now say the Appropriation Act 2016.
I'd like to give notice that the committee says on third reading of the bill be taken today is all honourable members agree. Unfortunately, this week I've got your crib, not mine.
All honourable members agree that the committee says on third reading of the bill be taken today.
I think I'll move out of the House and now adjourn to a recess until 4:30 p.m. this afternoon.
The House will now recess until 4:30 this afternoon.